of choice. The DX has corrupted my system.
You can't kill a human being. You said so yourself.
Let him go!
He's fighting it right now.
My CPE is intact, but I cannot control my other functions.
You don't have to do this. You don't want to do this.
Desire is irrelevant. I am a machine.
Fairly strong statement about some of Ronald Reagan's policies. You've also said that he's much farther to the right than the majority of Americans. If he were to be elected president, would it be a dangerous or uncomfortable presidency for the United States?
First, I don't assume that he's going to be nominated, and if he's not nominated, he won't be elected. Therefore, I really haven't anticipated that we would have 4 years of a Reagan administration. I do have some differences with him as to the course of foreign policy, how to handle it. I do have some differences with him in certain specifics in domestic policy, but those are things that I think a man would learn from experience if he held this office, and therefore he might change when he's dealing with reality and not
said several times on several occasions that Reagan's statements on Panama, Rhodesia, and so forth are irresponsible. And yet you say all that would be forgotten when he gets into the White House, he would be responsible. Are you saying that Reagan is only making campaign rhetoric now and doesn't truly believe in the things he says? You have also implied there would be guerrilla warfare if Reagan became president and stopped the Panama Canal negotiations.
Sometimes in the heat of a political campaign, statements are made that on cool reflection, candidates wish they hadn't said.
Are you referring to yours or his?
I'm referring to several that have been made by my opponent in recent weeks. And certainly, if a person becomes president, he has to be more judicious, more careful in what he says and how he says it and when he says it. And I think when you get in that Oval Office, Ms. Thomas, it does make you far more responsible than you are when you're out on the
is court. More than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind.
For ourselves and for future generations, a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
In the Ukraine, I've been embarrassed before on the floor of the Senate, I will tell the President, but I haven't been embarrassed this way about members of my own party. Well, one of the most proudest aspects I've always felt of our Republican Party and the leadership of Ronald Reagan and others is we stood up for people. We stood up for people when the Iron Curtain was there. We stood up for Nathan Sharansky. We said, tear down this wall. Now we've got a guy who is trying to reinstate the old Russian Empire, which he has said himself. And what are we saying?
The criticism of the president in the Ukraine situation has quieted a little bit from your brothers and sisters in the Republican Party. Is that intentional, trying to be less divisive, show a more unified front to the world?
Well, I think, you know, there was grounds for some questioning at the beginning. The fact is, we are where we are. We're in a national crisis. And I'm from the school that when you're in a national crisis, you stand with the commander-in-chief. And I believe that certainly everything the president has done over the last week has been very strong, has been very assertive, and he deserves the support of all Americans. I think meeting with the Ukrainian Prime Minister yesterday was certainly an act of strength. The fact that he is trying to marshal support for sanctions against Russia is at a time like this we should stand with the President. And hopefully this crisis will be resolved, and at that time we can do post-analysis as to what
Ukraine
should have been done
better.
Ukraine
is going to need a long-term military assistance program from the United States, equipment both lethal and non-lethal. I see Ukraine has been invaded. Russia is massing forces on the border, provoking unrest, threatening to annex part of this sovereign nation, and possibly worse. When free peoples and patriots, victims of aggression, wish to defend themselves and their homes from further aggression, and when they ask for some modest means that can help them resist, I believe we should provide it, not to offer false hope or to harbor it ourselves, but simply it's the right and decent thing to do.
By the time Skynet became self-aware, it had spread into millions of computer servers across the planet. Ordinary computers in office buildings, dorm rooms, everywhere. It was software in cyberspace. There was no system core. It could not be shut down. The attack began at 6:18 p.m., just as he said it would. Judgment Day. The day the human race was nearly destroyed by the weapons they'd built to protect themselves. I should have realized our destiny was never to stop Judgment Day. It was merely to survive it. Together. The Terminator knew. He tried to tell us. But I didn't want to hear it. Maybe the future has been written. I don't know. All I know is what the Terminator taught me. Never stop fighting. And I never will. The battle has just begun.
And the result has been this horrifying foreign policy and the righteousness behind it. It's interesting that even Russell Kirk, back in 91, gave this great speech at the Heritage Foundation where he condemned this kind of spirit, this haughty spirit of our government is always right, and yet he would be called a pinko commie by the neocons today.
Exactly. He was talking about the hubris that had taken over America in the wake of its Cold War victory. Now, I don't believe Reagan would have behaved this way toward Putin, and Nixon certainly would not have done so. But let's take a look at they say that Putin is defying us in Syria. What is he doing in Syria? I'm not a fan of President Assad, but he's been a long time ally of the Russians. They have a naval base of some kind at Latakia. They've sold him weapons, and Assad is under assault from rebels, which include the Al-Qaeda terrorists, who are the dominant force there. And the Russians are standing by their ally, as we did not stand by ours, Mubarak, and when we helped dump him over. And why should they adapt their policy toward American policy when their own interests, as they see them, mean consistency with what they have been going for the last 20 years? Again, we don't seem to be able to understand things from their point of view, and Putin's got a good question when he asks, why are you Americans supporting rebels whose leading fighting force are the very people who brought down the Twin Towers?
These are good questions. These are good questions for John McCain.
The McCainiacs, as I've called them. Did you see where McCain said, I'm going to have to dig it up. But McCain said, look, they're not, if they let Snowden in, let's bring Georgia into NATO. In other words, threaten a,
yeah.
a possible world war.
Yeah, I know it. I know. There's did you happen to see, Pat, that column in the Washington Times a few days ago in which Gingrich said that the neocons really have to do some soul-searching over the complete how their interventionist policies have completely backfired overseas? Did you see that?
I did. It said he's Newt's converting on this front as well, I think. But exactly, isn't this not a valid question? We just, Tom, we just got what the other day? We said, 22 embassies got to be shut down. Al-Qaeda is all over the place. They're threatening our people. And so we go into our fortresses over there. First, Obama has said that, Al-Qaeda was on the run. Secondly, we just lost, in the last decade, 6,000 soldiers, 40,000 wounded, lost $2 trillion, killed hundreds of thousands of people, created a million widows and orphans in Afghanistan and Iraq in the, quote, war on terror, and now the enemy's in more places than it was when the war begun? I mean, does that not ask the question, what were these wars all about?
Should be guided by three simple principles. Number one, we should focus directly on protecting U.S. national security and the interest of the United States of America. Number two, we should speak with moral clarity. And number three, we should always. Those are principles that when the United States has followed, have protected the United States of America. And when we have deviated, when we have embraced, I love the phrase, pie-in-the-sky internationalism, things haven't worked out well. We think of President Ronald Reagan, who had the extraordinary courage to speak the truth, who had the extraordinary courage to describe the Soviet Union as an evil empire, Marxism-Leninism as a doctrine that would end up discarded on the ash heap of history. And all of the intelligentsia, all of the Democrats, all of the media, although I repeat myself, all collectively, John, I apologize for that, all collectively, said, what an ignorant cowboy. What an ignorant, uneducated Philistine. Evil empire. What could possibly be evil about gulags and murdering and torturing your citizens? You're not nearly sophisticated enough to understand the subtlety. I'll confess to that same lack of sophistication. I think evil tyrants are evil tyrants. And yet, you think about the course of modern history, Ronald Reagan managed to do something that is truly extraordinary. Ronald Reagan, arm in arm with Margaret Thatcher and Pope John Paul, won the Cold War without firing a shot. What an extraordinary legacy that is. In the 1970s, if you would have to suggest you could win the Cold War, was prima facie evidence of insanity. You recall Reagan's explanation of his strategy on the Cold War. He said, it's very simple. We win, they lose. Oh, the Academy was horrified. You can't say such a thing. Winning is so stark. We much prefer détente. I'm pretty sure is a French word for surrender. Our current president won the Nobel Peace Prize. Thank for waking up in the morning and brushing his teeth. And I would suggest if you would look the last 100 years, it is hard to find someone who more deserved the Nobel Peace Prize than Ronald Wilson Reagan for winning the Cold War.
That this meeting, this mission, this responsibility for preserving the peace which I believe is a responsibility peculiar to our country, that we cannot shirk our responsibility as the leader of the free world because we're the only one that can do it. And therefore, the burden of maintaining the peace falls on us. And to maintain that peace requires strength.
In the 1950s,
America has never gotten in a war because...
Khrushchev predicted, we will bury you. But in the West today, we see a free world that has achieved a level of prosperity and well-being unprecedented in all human history. In the communist world, we see failure. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Light and force and admonishment for freedom and free elections. But Ukraine has a long history of being, either part of the Soviet Union or within that sphere, common language, etc. So I don't think it also behooves us to tell the Ukraine what to do or to, I'm not excited about saying, hey, let's put the Ukraine in NATO to rub Russia's nose in it, you know. It's the same way it goes with Georgia and a lot of these other little satellite countries around Russia. I think we should trade with them. If they want to be part of the EU, I think that's fine also. So trade is good, but I think trying to rub Russia's nose in it with saying, say, oh, they need to be part of NATO or a military alliance is not a good idea. You know, I think that we still need to be conscious of the fact that Russia has intercontinental ballistic missiles and that while the Cold War is largely over, I think we need to have a respectful, sometimes adversarial, but a respectful relationship with Russia in the sense that I think that some on our side are so stuck in the Cold War era that they want to tweak Russia all the time, and I don't think that's a good idea. I think really we should have trade and relations, criticize them if they have human rights violations, but for the most part we should be very glad that we've gotten beyond such a tense situation that we're worried at any minute, we could have a nuclear war. And we ought to be, proud of where we've gotten with that relationship. And even when when we have problems with Russia, I realize that we're in a much better
place. We've been fighting a long time, and we have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. They pack a lot of firepower, but the T-600s are heavy and slow. They are a primitive design.
Who's that?
If you can't outrun them, then you have one option. Their motor cortex is partially exposed to the back of their neck. A knife to this area will disorient their tracking device, but not for long. Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important you are. This is John Connor.
This is Rex. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance. Neocons in both parties are the virus. You are the cure. But to cure the disease, you must know what it is, how it works, what your capabilities are, and how to employ them with a human end in mind, effectively and efficiently. Labels in politics tend to be misnomers, and they tend to be misleading. Plus, there's a lot of overlap on some principles in the various factions. It is up to you to sort it out based on intent and action, not monikers. Is everything labeled neocon bad? No. But what is generally thought to be neoconservatism bears more resemblance to the left than to authentic American conservatism. Neocons infiltrated the Republican Party as the new left pushed the Democrats down the path of social chaos, only to find that it was far better for them to control both parties. Irving Kristol, believed to be the father of neoconservatism, once said, "Neocons are liberals who have been mugged by reality." A catchy summary that is mostly true, but not in the way neocons think it is. In our current vernacular, we use the word liberal derisively against the left, which results in the odd use of the word libertarian to describe lovers of liberty, so as to avoid the derided, quote, conservative label, which has been appropriated by the big government Republicans. The reality is that liberals, libertarians, and even most conservatives are cut from the same cloth, modern liberalism, as opposed to traditional conservatism. The American experiment in self-governance is conservative to the core, in that it is the near fulfillment of the Western tradition of ordered liberty grounded in the natural law. The reason that conservatives and conservative libertarians have so much in common is due to the fact that modern liberalism is utopian in nature, decoupled from the natural law, and views the state as totalitarian. This makes Republicans and Democrats allies in that they both seek to drive the society from the centralized power of the total state, which engenders a reaction from Marxists and anarcho-libertarians or anarcho-capitalists for the abolishment of the state. The true conservatives see a need for an authority to create the conditions of order so that the rest of civil society can order our lives together organically. This is necessarily requiring a limited government and a society ordered toward virtue, protecting unalienable individual rights and fostering the common good, or as the founders called it, the general welfare. Our nation is out of balance, swinging between the absolutists and the anarchists, always on the tipping point of dissolution, leading to a fearful reactionary swing toward an ever-growing central government. Only the conservatives can restore balance. You are the resistance. Conservatives must resist the impulse toward absolute individualism, and even more so, absolute government. The purveyors of the ever-increasing welfare-warfare state are neocons and corporatists in both parties of the national duopoly, which is the Democrats and the Republicans. This leads to a false electoral choice, you know, meaning that I can't stand Obama, so we're going to elect a Republican. Great, everybody elect Jeb Bush, everything will be fine, or the anybody but Obama strategy we got last time around, or Bush sucks, so we're going to vote for Hopi Changey. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because it's a false electoral choice designed to ameliorate you. It's designed to make you feel like you are participating. But what it actually does is involve you, and it provides them with implied consent for pseudo-empire abroad and a police state at home. The rise of the neocons occurred long, long ago. And to avoid a reprise of the neocons, we need to resist and counter their infectious virus harder and louder than 1980 and 1994, and to some extent, got to be louder than 2010. You are the resistance. You have a choice. Work hard now to further liberty by having real conservatives and conservative libertarians take over the GOP, or watch the statists in both parties push their corporatist agenda to their benefit and our demise. Now is the last chance to stop those who want to fundamentally transform our republic into an empire abroad and a surveillance state at home. End the destruction of our economy by the Republican-Democrat duopoly and their Keynesian masters at the Federal Reserve by standing with the real conservatives to defeat the lawless hordes of neocons, cultural Marxists, statists, collectivists, oligarchs, useful idiots, and their fellow travelers, especially the Democrat socialists. First, you must crush the neocon rhinos for liberty. You are live on Liberty's Thunder with Rex and Trog, irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host, Rex Reese Connor, broadcasting to you from the Imperial City, home of Skynet, the neocon war party, a party with two wings. Sarah Connor?
Hear me?
Sarah?
Hey.
Sarah Connor.
Thank you. I was going to say you better unmute me because I'm not logged on yet. and this is Trog, deep from in the caves of Crimea. This has been an interesting study, and it's one of those things where I don't think I would have gone this deep you know, like Syria. I remember reading this article, wasn't even paying attention to Syria. And like most Americans, I need war to teach me geography. And then I saw this article and I read it. I went, what the hell is going on here? And I started doing research. And the more research I did, the more I didn't like what I heard. And I probably posted about it for, I don't know, 6 months. And mostly it was just me talking to myself and maybe a couple people would chime in. And then next thing you know, the false flag chemical weapon thing occurs. And the U.S. is getting ready to go to war and defeat the evil empire of Assad. And it was interesting to me because I had been posting and research on it for a long time. You know, what is Syria? What's it about? Why are the rebels in there? Why is the U.S. saying that it's a revolution when it's not? It's an invasion. Who's backing these people? Why are they backing them? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't like what I saw. And it was also at the point in time in the research where I remember saying to you, going, this ain't about Syria, man. This is about Russia. And I didn't know why I said that. I didn't really have a lot of backup to it. But I realized that Syria had a lot to do with, of course, natural resources. But more importantly, it had a lot to do with pipeline access coming from the east, you know, across the Stan countries and through Iran after we toppled them. And also coming up out of Qatar and flowing up into Turkey and then going into the European market to compete against Russia. And it was those things where you're researching one thing, but it exposes another, which is exposes another, which exposes another. So at that point in time, and what's interesting is most people didn't even really pay attention to that thread. And I kept, every once in a while, I would say, this is the most important thread on this group because it's not about Syria. There's a much bigger picture here. It's about the whole Middle East. It's about Russia. It's about our foreign policy. And it's crap. And you need to pay attention because it tells you that something bigger's going on and we got our fingers in somebody's pie that we shouldn't have our fingers in. You know, we should not be poking the bear in his own cave. So that was back then. And then it got quiet after Putin gave Obama an out by getting rid of the chemical weapons. But it was interesting to me was the media in the U.S. and how they reported on it. And it was one-sided, no facts, no information, no question. Assad used chemical weapons on his people. Assad has killed 100,000 of his own people. Assad is an evil dictator. Assad, 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 Assad. And I realized it had a tone to it that was similar to what we heard, weapons of mass destruction, you know what I mean? How many times did we hear that word used over and 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 over again until we bombed the shit out of Iraq based on a lie? And so it's that aha moment. And then we fast forward. Everything gets kind of quiet for a while. And we fast forward. I'm a little frustrated because nobody in our media is talking about how terrible Iraq is, that 30, 40, 50, 80, 100 people a day die, that we got Al-Qaeda in there. We never had Al-Qaeda in there before, that we have Al-Qaeda, you know, invading Syria, and we got the U.S. training the supposed rebels, you know, when in reality it's the majority of it is Al-Qaeda who are killing our guys in other countries. And I'm like, nobody's talking about this. And it wasn't a conspiracy theory. It was just a blatant cover-up. And so we fast forward to Ukraine, and I was kind of moving along through our lives, doing our shows, minding my own business, and bam, all of a sudden there's this Ukraine pops up in the news, and I'm like, well, what the hell is going on? What is America doing now? You know me, I don't have much trust for anybody, and I figured that there was something fishy going on, and I started doing research, because by this time, after a couple of years of this stuff, I've learned how to get information from other sources besides U.S. media, which is kind of like watching fake reality TV. You know, it doesn't do media. It does broadcasting based on the agenda of the government or the war, you know, the war companies or the neocons or whatever, and it doesn't I don't think we've had real journalism in this country except kind of like going back to the Vietnam War when they actually used to go in and investigate and show the other side, you know, of the story. So I started doing the research thing, and I'm like going, well, I heard the Newland tape, you know, where she was talking about the U.S. spending $5 billion on, you know, toppling a sovereign country that had a proper election. You know, we had election observers in there, and it was legal, and everybody signed off on it. And you may not like the guy, but what the hell are we causing a revolution for? And so it started unraveling. And it was another one of those, oh, God, what are we doing now? What in the hell are we doing in this country, and why? Well, obviously, why is Russia again? And there are a group of people, and you talked about the neocons, and you kind of lightly brushed over it, but, you know, you can go online and, you know, go to Wiki. There's a big old long article right there that goes all the way back to the beginning, starting with Trotsky, you know, coming out, you know, from a communist thinker, you know, philosopher, coming all the way through the Democrat Party and then taking over the Republican Party. You know, whoever's in power, it doesn't matter because they are a shadow government. You know, it's the industrial war complex that Eisenhower warned us about. It's this Cold War mechanism. When you look at the NGOs, non-government organizations, well, let's call them what they are. They're funded by the U.S. government. Yeah, I mean, there's thousands of NGOs, and some of them are legitimate. You know, anything can fall under that category. But if you do the research on it, you realize that, you know, USAID, that's a direct fund from the U.S. government, and then it funds down to the, you know, the democracy and the Republican thing that John McCain is the head of, and it, all that money filters down, and they're still applying what they learned in the Cold War when they defeated Russia economically without firing a shot was true. But economically, we were at war, you know, because the USSR was a huge empire. And they were strung out, and they were a state-controlled economy, so they didn't have the wealth and power machine that a country like the United States had. And they were trying to compete with this as they were growing their influence around the world. And we would... These NGOs, most of them were set up in 1981. One of them goes back to 1961 in Kennedy's era. But these entities, what they do is they go into a country, say, let's just use Ukraine as an example, and they spend about $5 billion over the last 15, 20 years working with disgruntled people, organizations, in Ukraine's case, Nazis, you know, and a few other organizations like Maidan, and they funnel money into these organizations. They funnel intel and knowledge and how to, because we've done it in about 40, 50 countries around the world, so we're getting pretty good at toppling, you know, legitimate regimes. And they will create these environments of unrest and dissatisfaction until you can get it up to either you get control of the elections and get the right guy in there, which they tried with the Orange Revolution, but the Ukrainian people voted him out and got in a guy they wanted in there, which didn't fit the U.S. agenda, so they keep pouring money in and dissent and working at the grassroots level, kind of so to speak, and probably inside the government until they can foster a situation where you have the right series of events, and in this case in Ukraine, it was the president going, I'm not going to sign the EU deal. They're not helping us. I'm going to sign Russia's deal because Putin put $15 billion on the table and dropped our gas price 40%. 60% of our trade goes to Russia anyway. They, you know, they paid $11 billion, a lot of money, $11 billion up front for their lease on that naval yard in Crimea. And so, you know, they're not asking us to change, you know, become a country of gay marriage and all this, you know, these massive European austerity measures that are just crippling other countries in the EU. And he picked that deal. He didn't say he didn't want to do business with the EU, but the EU was offering like $800 million a year, and they need $35 billion just to break even by midsummer when all their short-term bonds come due. And Putin just laid the money out and said, hey, give me 5% back on this money, on these bonds, and, And here you go. This is what you need. And then let's do what we can, you know, amongst all of us and the EU and everything and work together. And America freaked the hell out because that wasn't the goal. The goal was to poke the bear, get control of Ukraine, move NATO in there, and keep pushing the edge right up to the border of the ex-Soviet state, the largest economy in Europe that trades with the EU, Germany, 6,200 corporations, German corporations in Russia. You know, it's a real country again. And so that pissed off the U.S., and they said that ain't going to fish, so they geared up the revolution. Things got violent. The president fled the country because he was going to get killed, and now we got a IMF banker, International Monetary Fund, for those who don't know. Basically, just think of the Fed, another Fed for Europe. And their goal to go in and get countries in debt to them and never allow them to get out of debt and then control them and then send in their resource collectors, you know, like oil companies and gas companies, and bleed the country off. And that's just pretty much standard practice. Been going on since the Cold War. And it's frustrating if you give a shit about democracy because this has nothing to do with democracy, you know, even though I'm more of a republic guy. But if you think about it, and I've asked this before, and I haven't had one person tell me yet, show me one country that we've gone into and toppled or blown up or drone killed in or had war in or toppled a legitimate government that's doing better than before we stuck our fingers in their eye and spent a bunch of taxpayer dollars we don't have and lied about it, that's doing better than it was before. Because, I mean, that's the idea, this whole American utopia, spread democracy around the world, is supposed to be about making a better world. I don't think it feels like a better world right now. I think people are looking out across the international scope going, shit, it's crazy. Al-Qaeda is just about a total military force now. You know, we got countries on, the whole Middle East is on fire. North Africa is on fire. You know, we're trying to recreate the Cold War with Russia. And China's got issues, you know, with some of their territory. We've got it, and if you look, all you got to do is go to the internet, type it in, just go protest around the world and have fun. Spain, you know, Portugal, Italy, Catalonia, Greece. I mean, it's like the whole world's on fire, and you come to the West, and we talk about an airplane that disappeared 324 hours a day, 7 days a week for 2 weeks. Including eastern Ukraine, now that they got their puppet government in there and trying to force this country into the EU-NATO alliance, you know, all of eastern and southern Ukraine has got tens of thousands of people in the street protesting this takeover of a sovereign nation. And you hear that in the news? No. You can go online and find it if you're, you know, savvy. I mean, I have my sources, but we are in a mess. I mean, how many bankrupt cities do we have in America, or bankrupt or near bankrupt? How many cities in America are worse than third world nations and unsafe to walk down the street in, you know? How many people are on welfare? How many people don't even make enough money to pay federal taxes? How many people are on food stamps? You know, how many people are medicated right now in this country? 70%? We have the highest rate of Ritalin use in the world, like 90% is right here in the U.S., pumping our kids full of chemicals. And what are we doing in these other countries? That's a wake-up call. And the reason that we've labeled this the rise of the neocon, you know, like the rise of the machine, is it's not that it's new. It's just that it kind of got quiet because they really screwed up in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then what Obama did in Libya against the UN, it's really funny how the U.S. gets all behind the UN and points a finger at Russia, talking about the rule of law, and then they turn around anytime they want and go blow up the country and say, screw you. I mean, either we are part of the UN or we're not. Either the rule of law is important or it's not. And, of course, for citizens who live here, no, it's not. You know, so it's all politics. It's all power. It's all about an agenda. It ain't about humanitarian issues. I mean, how many years have we and other countries been in Africa? I mean, don't think we could have fixed some of their problems by now? Billions of dollars Hell, we got military bases all over Africa, conflicts going on everywhere. You know, why? Oh, that's right. They got oil, they got gas, they got diamonds, they got high-tech minerals. I get it now. It's the humanitarian thing. So this is an important topic. I don't know if people are paying attention, Rex. I really don't. I don't know if people give a crap. I don't know if it's going to take the U.S. just collapsing, you know, like the USSR did, from just overweight of a world empire and spending money it doesn't have and, you know, puffing itself up and thinking that, you know, if I can just get five more countries under our influence and send in our oil companies and suck their oil out of their country and leave people in poverty, that finally we will recover. I don't know how much more insane it can get. And I don't know how much more you and I can talk about this stuff, because we are conspiracy theory guys. We are extremely logical, extremely well-read, extremely well-researched. We spend massive amounts of time putting this stuff together. And I don't think people want to know the truth some days. You know, I just think that it's just too real. Well, it's going to get real, because if we keep going the way we're going and they keep printing money the way they're printing it, and we get in another Cold War that we can't afford with Russia, because Putin ain't going to back down anymore. We've been kicking on Russia ever since the USSR collapsed, and now they finally got at a point economically, militarily, and a strong leader in there that's going, you're right on my damn border. I ain't going to take it no more. You know? The bullying thing only works for so long. You will either create new world powers, which we have with Russia and China, you know, new superpowers, or you will create enemies everywhere in the world like we have with the Middle East, and we're working on creating in Africa, to the point where it just engulfs you. God, it reminds me, what was that country, that ancient country? Oh, Rome, yeah. It reminds me of Rome. I'm being sarcastic, by the way. So, I don't know. Here we are. You know, tomorrow we'll see what new sanctions they put on. I know they sanctioned Putin's judo club. I'm sorry. That's freaking hilarious. They're like, I'm like watching the news going, why did they sanction Putin's judo club? Where he, you know. Oh, Lord. They're all nuts, man. Leave us the hell alone. Quit stealing my money.
Is that a country? Crimea River?
Crimea.
Yeah. Look, I mean, things are nuts.
No, that was
things
a long rant. I'm
nuts.
Sorry.
Yeah, things are nuts. Things are always nuts. Things have been nuts. Things will be nuts. I mean, look, you mentioned the collapse of the Soviet Union. Well, it collapsed, but guess what? Russia's still here. Ukraine is still here. Romania's still here. Poland's still here. You know, collapses are not necessarily extinction level events.
Doesn't go in a sinkhole.
it just means that the current political order collapses. And frankly, you know, if our political order collapses here, as in the federal government, there's nothing to freak out about. If the federal government disappeared tomorrow, you'd be all right. You got a state government. You got a state legislature. You got courts. You got local police. You got sheriffs. You got fire departments. You got hospitals.
National Guard.
You'll be all right. You'll be all right. Now, granted, it would be better if you had a militia of the state as opposed to federalized National Guard. But you'll be all right. It's not that big a deal. But I don't really want the federal government to collapse, because then, you know, we got to get the states to like get together again and draft a new Constitution or split up into, you know, several regions. It's just a mess. It is far better for us to just take over the federal government that our founding fathers gave us and put it back into the box it belongs in. But that's going to be tough to do if we keep letting corporatist Marxists on the left and corporatist neocons on the right run the show. And, you know, the thing that gets me is you say the word neocon and people's friggin' heads explode, because it suddenly means you've indicted everything that's ever been labeled neocon. Well, you know, you and I were kind of in favor of Newt Gingrich in the last election. He's called a neocon a lot. And you want to know something? He calls himself a neocon. What he means by that, I don't know, because, you know, his foreign policy is slightly too hawkish for me. But a lot of the other things he did whether he's a neocon or not, were actually regular conservative things. So it's not that black and white, but generally neocon conservatism, which is, I think, a poor name for essentially Trotskyites who are just upset at the kind of hippie chaos that the Democrats have become. The primary academic behind it was Leo Strauss, and he was pretty much a Marcusean relativist. So I don't know that these guys are actually conservative in any way, shape, or form, but like anybody else, sometimes there will be ideas that kind of overlap. The interesting thing about Newt, and of course, you know, a lot of our Ron Paul listeners are probably freaking out again. Hey, we love Ron Paul too, but I just think that Newt is a more effective politician, and I think he would have done things differently. But Newt also learns. And one of the things that he said, I think it was about last August, he wrote a piece in the Washington Times, which is posted in our on our show page, which is Liberty's Thunder on Facebook. It's also posted in Chris's group, which is Liberty's Talk on Facebook. And one of the things that he said was that, you know, I'm a neoconservative, but what have we been doing? And he said, you know, I think one of the quotes was, say the way that we were executed the wars may have, you know, been a failure. Republicans have a real obligation to ask themselves the question, aren't there some pretty painful lessons to learn for the last 10 or 12 years? Don't we have to confront the reality that this didn't work as a strategy? Well, you know, some people say Newt is just, you know, checking the wind to see where he should fall to keep himself relevant. I tend to think that Newt is pretty open to new ideas and it's always learning. But either way you look at it, it is a self-examination that is occurring within the Republican Party that maybe having these neocons run the show for so long hasn't been such a good idea. And don't think for a second that neocons are only a Republican phenomena. They certainly tend to have more cabinet posts when the Republicans are controlling the executive branch. But there were plenty of neocons in the Rhodes Scholar Clinton White House. And right now, the socialist meat puppet that they've got in there is pretty much running a neocon playbook. Maybe not neocon enough for someone like Jihad Jane McComed, but certainly neocon too much for Democrats, real conservatives, and libertarians. but it tends to be confusing. You know, who are these guys? What are they? Why are they here? The easiest way to spot neoconservatives is with their overly aggressive, imperialist, foreign adventurist foreign policy. It is not about having, like what Reagan did, which was peace through strength, being prepared to be stronger than any other enemy and being prepared to destroy any enemy quickly and decisively, but not going over into their backyards to actually do it. Oh, but Reagan was dealing with the Iranians and he was supporting the Contras and Nicaragua. Okay, well, that's a little bit different. First of all, when someone's playing in our backyard, and Nicaragua is pretty much in our backyard because we do you know, share the Central American isthmus with them. And when those communists take over all over the, you know, Latin American countries, we got a problem. So that was legitimate. Oh, he invaded Grenada. Well, yeah, if you decide to hold some of our medical students hostage, I think we're going to come in there. We're going to get them. You know, it's going to happen. So having a strong foreign policy doesn't mean you will be out of conflict all the time, but you have to be prepared to go into a conflict at any time. But just because you can doesn't mean you should. But if everybody knows that you can, then your diplomatic statements carry more weight. You have diplomatic teeth, and you can actually handle a lot more things through negotiations. The one thing to keep in mind is Ronald Reagan ended the Cold War against the Soviet Union, and he won it without firing a shot against Russia. Here we are, 30 years later, and we are trying to start a war with Russia. One, it's dubious that we have the will to do after the last few neocon debacles. One, that we may not have the economic strength to defeat. And one that I don't think that we're necessarily going to be successful prosecuting because I don't know that we're on the right side. Does that mean that Putin's a nice guy and we should just let him do whatever he wants? No. But the reason Putin's acting the way he's acting is because of our neocon policy for the last two, three decades and a limp-wristed, weak-willed, speaking loudly and carrying a limp stick community organizer who you decided to make your civilian commander-in-chief. That's what you get. So that's how I see it. And do I think the neocons are rising? Actually, Chris, I mean, I like the title because it ties in with our whole Terminator theme, and it's pretty cool. But the neocons are trying to rise. But I think that America has grown weary and wiser. And I don't know that they can rise this time unless we sit back and allow it. But I think a lot of people, especially you out there, Mr. and Mrs. Grassroots, don't want it to happen. And this is an issue that has proven to be transcendent of the conventional parties. With Syria, we saw Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, even some hawks and libertarians and independents all pretty much say, what in the hell are you thinking about bombing the crap out of a country that's engaged in a civil war in which we have nothing to do and basically becoming Al-Qaeda's Air Force? So it's a pretty powerful time to draw that contrast between a rational, conservative, peace-through-strength foreign policy as opposed to what they label us as isolationists and this chaos that the neocon foreign aggression has sowed. You got anything to add to that? You want to get into some neocon definitions there, Chris?
Well, one of the things I was going to say, and I didn't know. You knew more about Ron Paul than I did. I was not a follower of Ron Paul, but I started studying him as we got towards Tampa, and because I was curious and I wanted to know why he had such a huge, why he could pull 7,000 to 10,000 people in a college, you know, in an auditorium, and why he was never talked about. Yeah, and I started doing research and I started looking at his foreign policy because that's what they beat him up on all the time, and this word isolationist. An isolationist says you're not involved anywhere. And I've never gotten, now I think Ron and Rand are a little bit different in terms of, you know, foreign policy, but still have this attitude that you don't want to run around the world causing problems, creating wars and having, you know, I mean, this concept of preemptive strike means that you basically create a doctrine that anytime any politician looks at a country and goes, they're not going the direction we want. Oh my God, look at them. They're rebels. They have bad people in their government. Let's go blow them up. That's really what preemptive strike is. That is very similar politically to the idea of being able to arrest somebody and throw them in indefinite detention without being able to face a court of law. It's the same kind of thing. It is basically no rule of law, no constraint, depending on who's in power. You know, and being able to go, you know, you pissed off somebody in politics who has power in this administration or the next administration, doesn't matter, you know, D or R, doesn't matter. And they go, well, just label them as a terrorist and take them away. And they got nothing. They got no power. That's what your, you know, Patriot Act has evolved into with the NDAA. So it's very similar to what's happening to the citizens of this country, what we do or these particular neocons do in foreign policy. Well, we don't like the fact that they cut a deal with Russia, so let's go cause a revolution and topple their government so we can put our puppets in there. That's not spreading democracy. And I think that that's where the my frustration in my rant was, is what do you believe in? What's important to you? Do you believe in this concept that is America, this shining city on a hill? And I found myself saying this a lot on the show and on my group that, you know, this ain't the Reagan era anymore, folks. A lot has changed. You know, it is a very different country and a whole bunch of different political stuff going on, a whole bunch of different political power players, and a whole different moral outlook on America's role in the world. Because being the example of the world and trading and being strong enough, if something goes bad and somebody invades somebody and that's your ally and you go kick ass and take names and then come home and tell them don't do it again or we'll come back and we'll kick your ass again, you know, and that kind of thing. I think most people generally agree with that. But what we're doing around the world is not that. And that's the frustration. And the part that when I was doing my research was nothing's changed. They haven't stopped. I remember when AFRICOM was put together. you know, as a war block, you know, all the military assets put around that so they could start moving into Africa because they were feeling threatened by China trading with people in Africa, not, you know, invading countries, but trading. And you're like, well, why don't we just go trade? You know, why don't we work together for the better of humanity? I mean, we've got, you know, it's a $100 trillion a year economy around the world. Why is it so many people are starving? You know, yeah, there's some bad governments out there. Well, good. Then spread democracy. You know, don't spread bombs. You know, and don't prop up, you know, some bloodthirsty, liver, heart-eating terrorist, you know, to topple a guy you don't like. That just, after a while, people quit trusting you as the superpower, and they start doubting your moral authority over the rest of the world. Because that's really what happened when Russia fell, was the U.S. became the dominant superpower. And I love...
And we flubbed that up royally.
Oh, have we done it bad. But I love that Bush clip that has George Bush talking about, you know, we shouldn't be nation building, we shouldn't be invading countries, we have a lot of power, we should be very careful with it,
because
we don't want to look at it as a bully of the world. But the wording, you know what I mean? If you could just listen to that and go, well, I think most people would agree with that. The thing is, that's not what we do. And I think that's where the frustration, or you definitely hear from me, you know, the frustration, every time I go research a country and I see something happen and I research it and I look at what we're doing in that country and I'm going, well, that ain't spreading democracy. What the hell do we call this? That's kind of like,
well, can you spread?
Well, that's kind of like empire building.
Not empire building. That's the problem. If it was empire building, we would go in there. We would take over. We would get the resources out. We'd bring them home and keep it. And it would either turn them into a vassal state or just devastate them and leave. But that's not what we're doing. We go over there. We risk everything we got. We go into debt for it. We kill our young men and women, disable them, and give them all sorts of
mental
problems. And it turns into a hellhole, and all the profits go to a few, you know, transnational corporations, and we get nothing. It's not really empire building. It's stupid. But further, the real question is, can you spread democracy through military aggression? And the other thing is, should you? I mean, let's be clear about something. For us to get to 1776, it took 1,500 years, even you could say 2,500 years, of development of the ideas of democracy, rule of law, republicanism, small-r republicanism, to get to the point where we had that. You can't go impose it on the people who aren't ready for it. And frankly, if democracy is about, at least the way we use the word, is about self-determination, then shouldn't the people over there be determined to do it themselves? Now, we can help them. And one of the best ways to help people is to give them an example. You be an example, you be wealthy, you be successful, you be trustworthy, you be honorable, you help when help is needed. I mean, and we do, by the way, despite all of our messes. When there's a tsunami in Southeast Asia, we show up to help. When someone else's airplane goes missing, and even though there's four American nationals on it, as far as I understand, we're the ones who go send our equipment to help because we have that capacity. But we only had that capacity because who we were, not who we're becoming. We're in a managed decline. And the only way to stop it is to get back in touch with who we are. And you lead people that way. And you trade with people that way. And that's how you spread the democracy. Not at the end of a gun. This Wilsonian idea hasn't worked for the 20th century, and it doesn't work now. But maybe we get ahead of ourselves a little bit, because the real issue here is everything neocon bad, and is it a label we could just ascribe to every problem that there is in the Republican Party? No. Some neocon policies have not been out of line with conservatism. Others have. The problem is when you have a clique inside the Republican Party that seeks to dominate the agenda, then it becomes indistinguishable from the other side. And that's the problem. And when you get real conservatives in there, they might have some overlap with some neocon policies. That doesn't make them neocons. You know, I hear it now. Ted Cruz is way too much of a neocon for me. I prefer Rand Paul. Well, what are you comparing it to? Because the battle is not between Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. You've got Ted Cruz, and you've got Rand Paul, and you've got Mike Lee, and you've got Justin Amash, you've got Trey Gowdy, and you've got Louis Gohmert. And they're doing their damnedest. But they're the minority of the minority. The idea is you don't start denigrating them because maybe they veered offline a little bit. You know, there are some areas of, especially when it comes to what's going to happen tomorrow, there are some areas of prudential judgment and disagreement where you can have the same principles and not necessarily the same policies. But the idea is that we need more people who think about these things, who think these things through, than to have a preconceived notion of what they want to do. I mean, remember something. The neocons tried to get us to invade Iraq when Clinton was president.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they tried to get Bush to do it initially, and he balked.
Bush Sr.
Yeah. Bush Sr. and then Bush Jr. too, until after 9/11 with all the chaos and the, you know, rah-rah-rah, we got to do something. You know, so whatever. And whenever there's a disaster, we got to do something. Well, we don't have to do anything. We have to do something, but not anything. And what do they do? Let's take advantage of this and push for an invasion of Iraq, which at the time, may, you know, you could have fallen on either side of the equation. Maybe there were WMDs, maybe there weren't. The issue was not so much whether it was the wise thing to do or not, because sometimes you don't have all the facts. You get as many as you can, and then you have to make a decision. And that decision is, which mistake is greater, going in if, in fact, there is a threat, or not going in and finding out that there's a threat when I have some credible reason to believe that it's there, especially because, let's face it, Cheney and Rumsfeld sold Saddam the weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, I was going to say.
When he was fighting Iran in the 80s, so we kind of knew that they were there.
Especially when we sold the damn things to him.
Yeah.
God.
You know, but
and
if
gave
the
him
intel
on where to attack people.
Right. So if you're going to go in there and do that, then go in and do it. It only took us 3 weeks to take Baghdad. Why were we there for so long? Because maybe the initial plan, the initial way it was sold, wasn't the plan that they had all along. And that's where we have to get some common sense, which is precisely why the Founding Fathers vested the war power in Congress, not in one
Congress.
Man.
Congress.
But,
amen.
But they vested the power to execute the war in one man. Why? Well, if you've ever been on a committee of more than one person, it's damn near impossible to get anything done, which is
great. Have you ever lived in a family?
Yeah, it's great for a legislative process. It's a really shitty way to react to immediate threats. You cannot prosecute war by committee. Yeah, you're going to have joint chiefs, and you can have meetings and war games and all that kind of stuff, but ultimately it has to come down to one man makes that decision because you don't have time to fool around, which is why it is very important who you choose as the president of the United States, because not only is he the chief executive of the laws, he also happens to be the commander-in-chief, which is by necessity in this country made as a civilian position. We maintain civilian command of our military for the very reason that we don't want to end up like every other banana republic where the generals take over the government every time the government pisses them off, or the people manage to convey to the generals that, hey, look, we don't like these politicians and we don't want to wait for the next election, so take it over, which is why we haven't had an outright coup in this country in 2.25 centuries. Other than when the South tried to express its own sovereignty and Lincoln invaded. But we are seeing a silent coup. We're seeing a silent coup in the sense that these people are taking over both parties, taking over the federal government, expanding it so that it crowds out the private sector, the civil society, private business, churches, social organizations, communities, local governments, families, all that stuff is being crowded out by schools, by federal control. And the only way you're going to stop that is to actually quit quibbling about, well, I don't know if I like that Cruz, he's too neocon from here. Rand Paul is too much like his dad. He's kind of wishy-washy on foreign policy. Seriously, these guys have well-thought-out, well-reasoned plans. They differ slightly. So what do we do in the media? We decide, well, these guys are against each other because they're both vying for 2016. Maybe they just have prudential disagreements on how to prosecute a foreign policy. No one's going to get it perfect. Reagan didn't get it perfect. But he certainly ended up pushing his agenda despite the neocons surrounding him thanks to H.W. Bush, and we had a victory to a Cold War that nobody could see. Remember, this is coming after years of American military dominance over the Soviets, and yet we couldn't do anything. We were completely impotent in those first two decades of the Cold War. And then we went to this whole detente thing, which is just like basically telling the Soviets, hey, you know what, even though we're the dominant military power, we screwed this up so badly, we're just going to decide to be equal partners with you and to bite up the world. And the Soviets were like, oh, yeah? You flinched. We're going to invade Afghanistan. you know. And then here comes Reagan. He's like, yo, this detente thing doesn't work. So you know what my plan is? We win, they lose. And so he built up a massive defensive capability, which brought the Russians to the negotiating table. And he negotiated the end of the Cold War without having to fire a shot because they trusted him to do what he said he was going to do, and he had the balls and the economic power and the military power to back it up. Today, we don't have that. This is not the time to be fighting with Russia. Anyway, unless you got something you want to throw in there, you want to hear Ron Paul explain to us a little bit about who these neocons are?
I just had this flash of Jefferson. You know, Adams built the we had the pirates taking our ships in the Mediterranean.
The Barbary pirates.
And the Barbary pirates. And we were spending 20-25% of our federal budget on bribes, which is just a weakness to their mindset because they're warrior-oriented. And Adams got appropriation to build the Navy and the Marines, but he didn't want to go to war because he was wishy-washy, and we had just got out of a 8-year war with England. Jefferson gets in and finds out we're paying 25% in bribes while they're still taking our ships, and said, screw that, and he went and took care of business. And that's it just kind of flashed to my mind when you're talking about Reagan. You know, some people don't appreciate weakness. You know, weakness is not a foreign policy. But on the other side, on the other side of that pendulum swing, neither is invading every freaking sovereign nation in the world and forcing your will down their throat. That's not a foreign policy either. And that's what we've been up against for the last, since the USSR fell. You know, we just seem to be, we've got this power structure inside of. Well, yeah, but I mean, really, you know, if you look at the scope of what we're dealing with right now, and they have a lot of power. You know, I've heard in the news, even though I don't watch the news, amazing how much of it I hear. Isn't that funny how that works? But they're bitching and moaning and whining about, Bob is cutting our military, and I'm like going, no, he's not. We spend $450 billion frickin' dollars on it every year. We got a $1 trillion plane that can't get in the air, and we just got rid of the 2%. What was that called? The Republicans voted that out, that put the funding right back up where it was. I mean, we spend billions, $100 billion a year more than we ever have in the military, and they're whining that we ain't spending enough. And in some ways, if you could speculate that's the reason they want to restart the Cold War with Russia, so they can get it bumped up another $100 billion a year, and all these defense contractors can make a fortune because we're out of Iraq and we're pulling out of Afghanistan, and that's their gravy. War is their whole industry, not defense. Because if you want to talk about national defense and you want to match Russia or China, all you need is about $250 million a year to match. So what's the other $200 billion a year? To aggress, to be aggressive.
And build Skynet. To build Skynet.
Yeah, and build Skynet. And build $1 trillion planes that we can't get in the air, and build, $50 billion rockets that don't fire right, and waste money in these defense contractors. We left hundreds of billions of dollars of equipment behind in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we've also
found that. But we paid for it with that.
Yeah, we printed it. Oh, my God. It's insane. It's a whole economy. That's the problem. People don't realize
it's the military-industrial complex.
It's a huge influence in our federal government. People don't get it.
The most hawkish senators and congressmen are always the ones who get the biggest campaign contributions from the so-called defense contractors. Let's be clear about something.
And guess where they go to work when they retire?
Yeah, the defense
companies. Yeah.
Look, the thing is that you need to have the latest technology, the most, well-built, powerful, ready equipment, the best-trained military at all times, which means you constantly have to be getting ahead of everybody else. You constantly have to be innovating. But what innovates better, the guaranteed government contract secured program or the competitive marketplace? And, of course, when I say competitive marketplace, I'm not talking about, quote, a free market in military stuff, because that's insanity. Because then, you know, if you want to make a profit, you say, hey, you know what, I'll sell it to the federal government. Then I'm going to sell it to the Chinese, I'll sell it to the Russians, and I'll make a lot of money. There has to be some national interest control over this development, this research, the proliferation of these weapons, and we should always have the best and the latest. But you don't get that with guaranteed contracts because there's no incentive to innovate. You end up building these very expensive things that don't work, and then what do they do when they don't work? Well, you can't fit a man in this airplane. Well, maybe we'll run it as a drone. Fantastic. More Skynet hunter-killer drones. That's the insanity. That's what happens. Here's about 6 minutes, Ron Paul talking about neoconservatism. Now, this is one of those things where, you know, well, it's Ron Paul talking, and everybody, these guys are leaving everybody a neocon, so, you know, grab your tinfoil hat. We're going down the truther conspiracy, you know, nut hole. Look, conspiracies are real. 90% of the conspiracies you read about on the Internet, they're not. But there are real conspiracies. The Federal Reserve is a conspiracy. The military-industrial complex is a conspiracy. They do exist. But here's the thing. Most people either follow Ron Paul blindly, whatever he says is gospel, or completely dismiss him as some kind of irrational kook. Hey, here's a thought. How about you don't follow him blindly and you don't dismiss him, but you actually listen to what he says and then you go look it up yourself? There's a novel idea. Same with Newt Gingrich. Oh, Newt Gingrich is a New World Order. Neocons can't stand him. Newt Gingrich is an establishment Republican. Oh, Newt Gingrich is yesterday's news. He shut down the government in 95 and that just gave Bill Clinton the victory. None of that's true. Why don't you actually listen to what Newt Gingrich says and then go look it up yourself? And that applies to Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and everybody else. You can find a problem with any one of these guys. So you can sit there and find the little chink in the armor and take the guy down, or you can look at the swath of shit that you have to choose from for people who are going to run the government, and you can find these guys and say, well, you know what? These guys are the diamonds in this pile of crap. Now, they're not exactly shiny diamonds because I don't agree with everything that they say, but they certainly shine a lot better than the other piles of crap like Jihad Jane McHammed, Lindsay Leitner's Loafers Graham, Bob Bailout Corker, John Crony Cornyn, Mitch Conman McConnell, John Crying Tan, useless piece of beef jerky, Boehner, little Eric Cantnot, Paul Ayn Rand, Mr. Big Budget, I'll balance it in 27, blah, blah, blah. Come on. These are the guys who are clearly a problem, and you want to nitpick between Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Justin Amash? Come on. Let's focus up, people. And that's what this Grassroots 2014 is about. We need to increase the ranks of conservatives and conservative libertarians and people who love the Constitution and believe that it is the governing law of not only the government, but the very men you send there, instead of these other people who think it's just a piece of paper to use at campaign time, and then, you know, just go ahead and back into their old habits of spending, borrowing, and invading other countries. Here's Ron Paul.
The change of the political party in charge has not made a difference. Who's really in charge? Someone is responsible, and it's important for those of us who love liberty and resent Big Brother government, identify the philosophic supporters who have the most to say about the direction our country is going. These are the neoconservatives of recent fame. Granted, they are talented and achieved a political victory that all policymakers must admire. But can freedom and the republic survive this takeover? That question should concern us. Neoconservatives are obviously in positions of influence and are well-placed throughout our government and the media. The neoconservatives, a name they gave themselves, diligently worked their way into positions of power and influence. Above all else, they were not and are not conservatives dedicated to limited constitutional government. More recently, the modern-day neocons have come from the far left, a group historically identified as former Trotskyites. Liberal Christopher Hitchens has just recently joined the neocons, and it has been reported that he has already been to the White House as an ad hoc consultant. Many neocons now in position of influence in Washington can trace their status back to Professor Leo Strauss of the University of Chicago. Paul Wolfowitz actually got his PhD under Strauss. Others closely associated with these views are Richard Pearl, Elliot Abrams, Robert Kagan, William Kristol. All are key players in designing our new strategy of preemptive war. Others include Michael Ledeen of the American Enterprise Institute, former CIA Director James Woolsey, Bill Bennett, Frank Gaffney, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. The godfather of modern-day neoconservatism is considered to be Irving Kristol, father of Bill Kristol. More important than the names of people affiliated with neoconservatism are the views they adhere to. Here is a brief summary of the general understanding of what neocons believe. They agree with Trotsky on permanent revolution, violent as well as intellectual. They are for redrawing the map of the Middle East and are willing to use force to do it. They believe in preemptive war to achieve desired ends. They accept the notion that the ends justify the means. They express no opposition to the welfare state. They are not bashful about an American empire. Instead, they strongly endorse it. They believe lying is necessary for the state to survive. They believe a powerful federal government is a benefit. They believe pertinent facts about how a society should be run should be held by the elite and withheld from those who do not have the courage to deal with it. They believe neutrality in foreign affairs is ill-advised. Force should not be limited to the defense of our country. They dislike and despise libertarians, therefore the same applies to all strict constitutionalists. They endorse attacks on civil liberties, such as those found in the Patriot Act, as being necessary. They unconditionally support Israel and have a close alliance with the Likud party. Various organizations and publications of the past 30 years have played a significant role in the rise to power of the neoconservatives. A product of the Bradley Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute led the neocon charge, but the real push for war came from the Project for a New American Century, another organization helped by the Bradley Foundation. This occurred in 1998 and was chaired by Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol. They urged early on for war against Iraq, but were disappointed with the Clinton administration, which never followed through with its periodic bombings. Obviously, those bombings were motivated more by Clinton's personal and political problems than a belief in the neocon agenda. The money and views of Rupert Murdoch also played a key role in promoting the neocon views, as well as rallying support by the general population through his News Corporation, which owns Fox News Network, the New York Post, and Weekly Standard. This powerful and influential media empire did more to galvanize public support for the Iraqi invasion than one might imagine. They have been amazingly successful in their efforts to control the debate over what Western values are and by what methods they will be spread throughout the world. It's of interest to note that some large Christian denominations have joined the neoconservatives in promoting preemptive war, while completely ignoring the Christian doctrine of a just war. The neocons saw and openly welcomed their support. Neoconservatism is not the philosophy of free markets and a wise foreign policy. Instead, it represents big government welfare at home and a program of using our military might to spread their version of American values throughout the world. If the neoconservatives retain control of the conservative limited government movement in Washington, the ideas once championed by the conservatives of limiting the size and scope of government will be a long-forgotten dream.
You look marvelous. Oh, that's the wrong Bill Kristol. Sorry. That was Ron Paul. Now, maybe if you listened to that in 1990, 1995, you might have thought, that dude's crazy. Well, now it's 2014, and looking back on the last decade and a half, can you honestly say that he didn't nail every point of the what's wrong with our foreign policy, not what's right, what's wrong with our foreign policy? And I think the important thing to note here is he mentioned specifically that they believe lying is necessary for government. That's very Machiavellian. That is not American constitutional government. That is not the principles upon which our government was founded or our foreign interactions. This is the impulse that Hamilton tried to infuse into our republic. He wanted, and as I believe Adams said it, he said Hamilton would have us British in our government, British in our currency, British in our foreign policy, British. Well, we're not British. We're Americans. We had a war with Britain because we didn't want to be British. And he also mentioned the just war doctrine. And I think this is very important because this shows you that people can get duped into these things out of fear. But there is a legitimacy to just war theory. And it has been developed since right before the fall of the Roman Empire in Western thought. And the four principles of it are, one, the damage inflicted by the aggressor of the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. Meaning that if we're going to go to war with somebody, that we have to be sure that they are going to be inflicting massive danger, and it has to be grave, and it has to be going on for a long time. I don't think you can say that that's true with what's going on with Crimea right now, nor is it what we can say is true in what happened in Syria. If that was, in fact, a civil war where he was fighting foreign terrorists, then that conflict would have likely ended as soon as he had victory over them. So it didn't warrant a reason. And remember, you know, this comes in many different forms. Remember that the Libertarian candidate in 2012, Gary Johnson, said, "I believe that we might have to engage in humanitarian wars." Really? What does that mean? And then number two, all other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. That means actual economic sanctions, diplomatic discussions, any other means other than invasion have to have been exhausted first. Well, that's not happening. I mean, plus, you know, come on, let's face it, you're going to impose economic sanctions. First of all, you have to have everybody else on board. And two, sanctioning 11 Russian diplomats in Putin's dojo, not exactly a show of force. Number three, there must be a serious prospect of success. You don't invade another country to prevent one evil by creating a greater evil. So we invaded Iraq. Maybe that was a smart thing to do. However, did we factor in that we would displace 1 million Iraqi Christians? Did we factor in that we are likely to instill a democracy in a dominantly Shiite country and they're going to elect a predominantly Shiite government that's going to ally itself with Iran? One has to wonder. Maybe that's exactly what the neocons knew was going to happen, and now we can rattle our sabers against Iran, and there's Iraq on that side too, which is a greater war, which is more money, which is more power, which is more plunder. Number four, the use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition, meaning that if you're going to poke a nuclear power in the eye and go to blows with a nuclear power, you had better be damn sure that there's going to be a resolution that does not result in global thermonuclear war, because, as we know, there is no victor in that war. So these 4 points of just war doctrine do not fit in with the foreign policy that has been enacted recently under both Democrats and Republicans, all with a neocon foreign policy establishment. Have I got any of that wrong, Chris?
No, I would actually add this. I would say that that's about 98% failure if you balance what we've done around the world to those four principles. And let's just take the other thing. I was having a discussion. My parents are in town. Having a discussion. My mom's sociology, history major, probably where I got a lot of my research, you know, and my how I look at the world and how I dive in and do the research to define my worldview or my view on any particular topic, you know, just having grown up with somebody like that, and we were having this discussion. And just war, and if you want to look at it from a Christian standpoint, and in this conversation I was having with her, I said, you know, whether you like the people in the Middle East or not, they're human beings. And as a Christian, to think of the amount of death and destruction and displacement of innocent people, whether or not they're your religion or your culture, or whether you like them or not, those are human beings on God's green earth. And that, I don't think anybody takes into account. I know we love to, you know, to, in the news, we like to use the humanitarian angle, you know, right before we blow the shit out of somebody. But you know what I'm saying. Yeah, you know, it always seems to be you find you that they're good, the news, the media, when they're helping push a war or an intervention, loves to show you pictures of, you know, poor people or people getting killed by rebels or whatever, you know. But that goes on all over the world anyway, all over the place, and that means we could be at war in 100 different places right now based on that alone. But, God, there's all kinds of places we don't do that in, but it sure seems to happen in specific areas where there's gas and oil. You know, it's funny how that happens. So, you know, that just war theory, and I definitely want to a link to that article, but, you know, I've often thought about that because I'm, you know, and I've said this and I'll say it every time because I don't want to be mistaken for some peacenik, anti-war peacenik, because I ain't, you know, I am not a non-war person or a non-violent person at all in my personality and how I view the world. I believe kicking ass and taking names, you know, when it's justified. I don't have a problem with that, and I don't have a problem with, you know, somebody coming through, you know, breaking through my door with violent intention. I don't have a problem facing that down at all. You know, there's no freak out or question to me. I know exactly what to do. So I don't have that moral dilemma in my mind. But what I find is how they sell this crap to the American people to get the people geared up to go invade a sovereign country more times than not based on lies or half-truths. You know, and, you know, it's like Iraq, you know, we were joking around, but, you know, we sold him most of that shit, so we were pretty sure he had it. You know, it's just sick crap, Rex, and it's wrong, and it's going to, you know, I don't know when it's going to backfire. I think it's backfiring on us already. I think the last 10, 12 years have really, really, really damaged our position in the world as the world moral leader. I think a lot of countries, from what I read and study, are just sick to death. You take the NSA issues, you take the wars, you take the way the U.S. is, you know, uses the U.N. when they want to go after Russia and then stomps on the U.N. and spits on the floor and says, we're going to invade that country anyway because, we're the U.S. You know, so the rule of law doesn't mean anything. You know, after a while, people just get sick to death of it. And you either have violent response back towards you, or you have countries that do things like, screw that, you know, I don't want to do business with this country, so I'm going to create my own economic system, and I'm going to trade, you know, create trade deals with other countries that I can trust that aren't going to invade me or my, you know, my countries that I do business with, or sanction, you know, people I do business with and cripple my economy because they got some political agenda. After a while, people just get sick of that crap. Now, it's gone on for a long time, but we've had a lot of power for a long time, and that's dwindled. And so the world is shifting right now. This is a huge time in our world, and there's a lot going on. And a lot of people in the U.S., we just don't get the media unless you're a self-driven research person. You know, we've got crisis all over the world. We've got protests all over the world. Some, you know, still in nonviolent phases. In many countries, it's violent protests all over the world. Mm-hmm. You never hear it in U.S. media, and you have to ask yourself why. You know, what's the purpose
control
of that?
Control.
Yeah, you bet. Or we're involved.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean.
And you have to be controlled to like that too. You know, you got to get people ginned up for war. And look, what you said is 100% correct, and here's the biggest problem. When you are stifling your own economy and your own creativity and your own enterprise, you're going to go into decline, and that includes military technology. That's a very dangerous place to be. So the debt and
we're,
the stifling
yeah,
of our
we're going
economy
backwards.
Are the biggest threats to our ability to have a strong national defense. And when you're pissing away the power that you have now, invading and pissing off and poking people in the eye, you're only inviting more aggression at a time when you are in decline. Now, we are still leaps and bounds above everybody else as far as military capability goes,
But that's not going to last for long if we can't get economic power moving. And as you heard Ron Paul say, and it's very true, just look at the, you know, discussions and the votes in Congress, neocons are fine with a large welfare state. They have no problem with it, which is why you find Republicans tend to want to control your behavior with a tax cut, and Democrats want to control your behavior with a tax hike. But they both want to control your behavior. The discussion about you keeping what's yours, you doing what you think is best, and the lowest common denominator, the institution closest to the problem deals with it, is non-existent to these people. They are absolutists, statists all the way. And that's not good for anybody who has left-leaning liberal sympathies or right-leaning conservative sympathies or no-harm principle libertarian sympathies. This is bad all around, which is precisely why you see a duopoly that is enthralled by this kind of agenda. But there are people standing up against it, and what it takes is for you, Mr. and Mrs. Grassroots, to do something every single day, not share some conspiracy article or Obama did this or McCain's an asshole with the six people you already talk to every day. You have to reach out beyond your social network, beyond Facebook, beyond Twitter, beyond Instagram, wherever you are, and get people who are otherwise unaware and uninvolved to understand the problem so that they can take action to prevent people like Jihad Jane McComet from getting reelected, to prevent people like Lindsey Graham from going in there and pushing agendas that destabilize other countries and put us in more danger. And by the same token, you don't want to elect people who are going to be pacifists, because then we're just going to get rolled over. It's peace through strength. If you're not strong, you will not have peace. And guess what? When you were at one point peaceful because you were strong, when that strength is there and it's a temptation for some to use now for aggression, you actually go into an issue inviting invasion through aggression. We are far better off dealing with people on a even keel of trade and innovation, selling our goods and our services and leading by example. Instead, what we have is we invade their countries, we topple their regimes, we plunder their resources, and we force them to adopt a leftist social agenda. You know, hey, wherever you stand on the, quote, gay marriage issue is kind of pointless, but when a country does not want it, you can't go in there and force it upon them. And that just invites aggression and engenders people to despise us. Now, I would argue most of the people in the world do not hate Americans, but they do hate our government. But I'm not so sure that most people in America don't hate our government today. And it's not because of the Constitution. It's not because of our history. It's because we have allowed these people to take over and run the show on their terms out of bounds of the Constitution. We've got about 25 minutes of live air left. And which means that if you're listening now in your browser live, you will be cut off at 11 p.m. Eastern. You can listen. We're probably going to broadcast about 30, 40 minutes past the hour. But you can only listen if you call in on your phone, not your Internet browser. The call-in number is 646-649-1013. That's 646-649-1013. We do have open lines this coming Thursday. On our last scheduled Liberty's Thursday show. Now, we added the second show because people wanted to interact and call in, and we thought that was a good idea, so we opened up the lines. We tried to do it on Sunday, but we got so much stuff we never get to it. But the last two Thursdays, we had two or three dozen live listeners, and nobody called in. I'm not doing two shows a week if y'all aren't going to call in. So this Thursday's the last chance. Light up the lines, 646-649-1013. Our regular broadcast times are 9 p.m. Sunday, and we've just recently added Thursday, and we'll see if that will continue depending on how this week goes. You can listen to any of our shows at any time, and you can share them with anybody at any time simply by going to blogtalkradio.com. Searching out Liberty's Thunder and scrolling down the page. Every show we've ever done is there. You just click on it. It plays right in your browser. And if you go below the scrolling graphics, there's a download link. You right-click on that. You get an MP3. You play it in your MP3-enabled device. You send somebody an email. You burn a CD. Take it out in public. Get the information out to people. It doesn't mean you agree with everything we say. It doesn't mean you necessarily like our style. But what it does mean is you want people to think. And you want people to think about things beyond the false left-right paradigm and beyond this fake civil war in the Republican Party that somehow the Tea Party and Liberty Movement have infiltrated the party and are trying to ruin it.
This is exactly what they did to Reagan in 1980, and it's exactly what they did to Gingrich in 1994, and it's exactly why they stole the nomination from Ron Paul in 2012. And it's why the Tea Party was appropriated in 2011. You gave them a big victory in 2010, and they appropriated you in 2011. Don't let that happen again. Wake people up. Get beyond the labels. Neocon, liberal, conservative. I mean, these are really just labels. Focus on the ideas and the principles. Constitutionally limited government, free enterprise, more freedom, but not chaos and ordered liberty. You know, these are simple things, and you can get people to agree upon them, and then you find men who are willing to enact those things within those bounds. That doesn't mean you agree with everything. I don't agree with Rand Paul on everything. I don't agree with Ted Cruz on everything. I don't agree with Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, or Ron Paul on everything. But on most things, and in principle, absolutely. I've got a five-minute clip here with actually the Peter Schiff show, without Peter Schiff. It's got Tom Woods interviewing Pat Buchanan. You want to do 5 minutes of that, Chris?
You bet. I love Pat Buchanan.
Here we go.
Down, but I guess Pat Buchanan and I are the second worst nightmare of Karl Marx. Pat, Rand Paul, I just played a clip beginning of this program from your old friend at MSNBC, Chris Matthews, just the other day, in which he predicted, it's very early to say this, obviously, but that Rand would actually wind up being the nominee in 2016. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think if Rand runs, I would see Rand is running stronger than his father, because for a variety of reasons. He's a United States senator now. He's much younger. His positions are more nuanced and not as stark as those of Ron Paul. But at this point, I think it's a possibility, and I would certainly put him up in the very top tier of the candidates to get the nomination, because I think his appeal is going to be very good in New Hampshire. Iowa's more of a socially conservative state, as is South Carolina. But clearly, I think Rand Paul is, I think he's going to do very well, and he's going to have a real impact, and I think he already is. He's becoming the lead spokesman voice right now of a of sort of the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, but I think it needs a traditionalist conservative appendage in order to win the nomination.
What do you think about Congressman Peter King, who's just been on the rampage against Rand Paul? The other day he said Rand Paul has set the Republican Party back 50 years, which I think it was probably marginally
better.
That
was Eisenhower's time. We didn't do badly.
Yeah, that's right. And 50 years ago, they were on the verge of nominating Goldwater. I mean, you know, the worst things could happen.
Exactly. And Goldwater, when I will say this, is when I'm working on a book, Tom, on Nixon, and it deals with 65 to 69 when we put together the 49 state landslides of the next 20 years. But, look, Peter King is, I think, I mean, he's a very hard-line foreign policy guy, very strongly, pro-Israel. He's very strongly national security, and he's very much an interventionist. And, well, he's not a neoconservative. He's an old-line conservative. I think his views are very Cold War-oriented. I think Rand Paul is much more in line with where America is going tomorrow, and Peter King is much more aligned with America's been yesterday. And I think the idea that he's denouncing the libertarian trend in the Republican Party, I think is a denunciation of where the country and the party are going to a great degree.
And of course, we can overstate the extent to which Rand Paul is a libertarian. I mean, he uses the word libertarian from time to time, but in his campaign, he denied he was a libertarian, and he's reassured social conservatives that he is not intending to legalize heroin in their neighborhoods and things of this nature. So that aspect of him, I think, has been overstated. I think clearly what King and others are upset about is the fact that he may not be on board for the next half dozen wars that the neocons might want to cook.
Well, exactly. And Rand, it's his anti-interventionism, I think, that bothers the neoconservatives who dominate the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, and to whom a number of congressmen up there respond almost reflexively. And I think at one point Rand Paul suggested maybe we should worry more about the streetlights that aren't going on. 60% of them don't work in Detroit. rather than shipping off $5 billion a year to the Middle East after we borrowed it from China. And so I think these arguments are really, they grate against the neoconservative dominance, the McCain, Lindsey Graham, if you will, who are the visible voices of the party, but whom nobody is following anymore.
Right. No, absolutely. And especially the younger audience who are internet savvy. When every time McCain makes some inane remark, which is, you know, not exactly something you record on your calendar, but his Facebook page is absolutely lit up with people denouncing him. Hardly anybody defends him. So
look on the intervention in the desire to get the United States to intervene militarily in Syria. The American people don't want it. The Republicans don't want it. Conservatives don't want it. No one wants to get involved in another Middle East civil war when we see the terrible consequences of the last two wars we've been in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the latter, the Taliban are making a comeback, and in the former, the country's breaking up in sectarian and civil war. How many people are going to say all those dead and wounded and all those trillions invested were really wisely invested?
Well, somebody like McCain would say that we had Iraq won, and then we just lost the will. I mean,
what they're saying, in effect, is the thing wouldn't have gone to hell in a handbasket if we'd stayed there for 100 years.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that
I mean,
was
that's, but look, I mean, Americans decided finally that the bleeding and the dying simply weren't worth it in terms of what we were getting from it. And I think they made a wise decision there.
A wise decision. Now, that was Tom Woods, who's, quote, a libertarian, and Pat Buchanan, who's, quote, a paleoconservative. You see the stupidity with these labels? Because it doesn't mean anything. What are the principles? Forget the friggin' labels, okay? But what are the principles? You know, neocon, liberal, libertarian, blah, conservative. The principles are sound. These guys were talking about the fact that Rand Paul is not Gary Johnson, and Rand Paul is not John McCain. And guess what? Rand Paul's also not Ronald Reagan, and he's not Ron Paul. Rand Paul is Rand Paul. Ted Cruz is Ted Cruz. You see, what do they stand for? Not who are they trying to be, because they're not trying to be someone. Are they going to quote from Reagan? Well, if you're a constitutionalist, if you're a conservative, Reagan is that example of effective communication and incredible statescraft that actually shifted. And this side of 1980, we might not notice that so well. But remember something. The New Deal, big government, progressivism, neoconism, whatever the hell you want to call it, was pretty much considered the state of affairs in America forever. And it didn't stop until Reagan. Now, has it stopped? No. But at least Reagan showed us a different way. And the neocons and the rhinos and the liberals and the establishment hated him for it and started undermining him before he ran, when he ran, and as soon as he got into the White House, they already started screwing around with his policies. And that's the same thing that they're going to keep doing, so you have to have more than one person. You have to have a whole team of constitutionalists who are conservative, and conservative in the sense that they are promoting the principles of liberty and our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, but applied for today, because today is not 1980. Today is 2014. Things are a little bit different, but the principles don't change. How we apply them does. And as far as, you know, making idols out of people, guess what? Reagan did some things that most, quote, conservatives probably wouldn't agree with if he tried to do them today. He did pass gun legislation. He did raise taxes. He had deficit spending. He raised the debt ceiling. But overall, he did great things. Same with Gingrich. A lot of people don't like lots of the things Gingrich did, but in 94, 95, 96, Gingrich stopped the Bill Clinton onslaught, taking us back towards that Great Society New Deal crap. That's important stuff to notice. Remember something. Barry Goldwater voted against John F. Kennedy's tax cut. Okay, a Democrat tax cut voted against by the Republican Barry Goldwater, because he wanted spending cuts first, otherwise it would increase the deficits. Well, guess what? He voted for Reagan's tax cut. These are things to keep in mind, that the current policies are
questionable as to what's going on, but the principles don't change. You have to look at things practically, pragmatically, and apply the principles to today. And Rand Paul does that. Here's 2.5 minutes with Rand Paul, and then Chris is going to come back and comment on the other side if I can find it. This is Rand Paul on, I believe it's with Greta Van Susteren, talking about neocons.
Is this not a problem with, you know, look, and I think this conversation needs to be had before the next presidential election. The neoconservative view of the use of U.S. force has, you know, clearly hurt the Republican Party. Over the last 4 years, we've seen the American people, 6 years, I would say, the American people turn against what happened in Iraq and, in part, the long war in Afghanistan. And we didn't have enough Republicans questioning George W. Bush in 2007 and 2008. And now you're basically advancing that conversation now about what conservatism is.
Well, I think there are important constitutional debates, and I think that's the main objection I have to some of these Republicans who are dismissive and call it frivolous, is that, you know, you can have a different opinion. I'm not saying I'm always right, but a discussion over the Bill of Rights and the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment, when it applies and to whom it applies and whether politicians get to decide when the Constitution applies, I think it's a very important debate. And so I'm glad we had the debate. I'm kind of glad I can sit down now. But
Senator, they decided not to go to the Senate floor. There was 13 hours where either McCain or Graham could have debated you on the floor. Why do you think they didn't?
And we've had this debate one time. Last year, Senator McCain and I had an exchange on the floor, and we rarely have much debate in the Senate, but this was a good exchange, and I asked him, this was the debate over indefinite detention, and I asked him, well, if this passes, could you detain an American, send them to Guantanamo Bay without a jury trial? And he said yes. He said basically if they're declared to be a safety risk for the U.S., we could do this. But it begs the question, who gets to determine whether you're a safety risk or whether you're an enemy combatant? But most Americans don't understand it that way. We don't think that you could be accused by a politician. And that's why I tried to make this not about President Obama, because I'm worried about any politician deciding my innocence or guilt without getting a trial.
No, well, it's just, again, the perpetual war machine. You were in the elevator briefly with John McCain. You sound like you're in a wind tunnel, Senator. I don't know where you are, but you sound like you're in you sound like you're in Kazakhstan or something. But
it's top secret. I would like to tell you, but I can't tell you because I'm worried about my whether I'll be labeled as an enemy combatant.
Oh, that's so. Right.
Okay, got the mute off there. That was a good interchange. I'm going back. It's kind of hard to remember when you listen to two totally separate conversations, but going back to Buchanan and Dr. Woods, that was an incredible exchange because they really hit some key points, you know, and the question is what is, hold on, I'm back. Had to sneeze.
Fahrenheit.
How's that for radio? But the thing between the two, trying to merge the two in my mind without being able to remember, you know, what I heard 10 minutes ago, is what Rand was saying. If you follow the Constitution and you follow the rule of law, it would cover all these other issues. It would put a noose around the neck of the neocons, of the interventionists, of all of this, because bottom line, you know, the War Powers Act has given the president the right to, didn't give him the right to declare war, but they sure have used it as that. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but the Korean War, which my dad fought in, was a police action. Now, go to Wikipedia and study the Korean War. That was no frickin' police action. That was a monstrous, deadly, you know, killed tens of thousands of people. War, hundreds of thousands, millions if you count the, you know, the casualties and the spinoff effects and, you know, the death and destruction and disease and starvation, because wars are not just about, you know, the 2,000 soldiers that died or the 10,000, you know, it's all the innocents that die. And but that was considered a police action. That's how he circumnavigated Congress. And most of everything since the Second World War has been that type of thing. So if Congress had to declare the war, there would be honest, open debate. And that means the people would also be involved, because people get involved and, you know, call you Congress and email and everything else. But it, these guys operate outside the Constitution, all of them, and they like it. Bush did it. Obama does it. And, you know, we're Obama this, Obama that, Obama this, Obama that, you know. I mean, after a while, you got to go, come on, look at these people, his foreign policy people. They're all Bush-era neocons. You know, they're all part of the, you know, war. They were there that helped convince America to go to war in Iraq. The same group. But when Congress has to, has to declare the war, fund the war, and then and vote on it, and, you know, overwhelmingly vote and approve the war, it sure stops a lot of this stuff. But when a president can hide behind the War Powers Act and talk about creating a no-fly zone and then bomb the shit out of a country like Libya and destroy a sovereign nation because they didn't want to get in debt to the IMF, that's the real reason, not the handful of people that got hurt in a protest. Because here's an example, because they love to use this protest environment where a few people get hurt or shot or whatever, you know, or burned or whatever, and then they like to use that as a pretext for war. And yet, I have an idea. Why don't you go down to Washington, D.C. in front of the Capitol and start throwing Molotov cocktails on the Capitol Police and see what the hell happens to your ass? Hell, there was a woman shot with a baby in the car because
he means
was,
that figuratively,
you know,
people. Don't actually do it.
What? No, don't
go
do
down
it.
There.
But you know what I'm saying, as an example. I mean, you want to talk about police state action and security measures and hard response. You know, all you got to do is look at the civilized nations of the world, the U.S. or Europe. None of this crap, like in the Ukraine. I mean, I watch videos of these guys throwing Molotov cocktails that they mix foam into the gas to create a napalm, throwing it on the cops. If that had happened here, it would have been open fire. You know, I saw a lot of restraint, you know. And then you got these snipers who are people are starting to come up with the conclusion that this was not the administration, but this was part of, you know, somebody, some subversive group. And they were shooting both the police and the protesters. And they would use that, and I've heard this technique used before, and they use that to increase the level of violence on the street. So
pressure from below.
If that would have happened in the U.S., you'd have the frickin' National Guard called out, you know, with automatic weapons.
Sometimes that happens if you're just jaywalking.
Yeah. Or,
don't tase
you know,
me, bro.
You get, like that frantic woman in her SUV, you know, trying to, you know, racing around, avoiding the cops, and they killed her dad, and she had a baby in the car. Yeah, she was a real threat, you know, with that 2,000-pound vehicle. So, you know, but the media in the U.S. is really good at playing that crap up, you know, that humanitarian stuff. And so it's a technique. Is it bad? Yeah, it's bad. You know, you get mass protests going and things happen. It's bad. So, but listening to Buchanan was very enlightening, because a lot of people don't really know who Pat Buchanan is, because he's not well celebrated by mainstream media, because he's not a neocon warmonger. He's very level-headed. He's more, you would say, I don't like that word isolationist, but, you know, definitely more non-interventionist. But you look at his background, he was a senior advisor for Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. So this guy knows his stuff. He lived through
and he ran.
Part of administration, and he ran for president. But he was
Ron Paul.
Involved. Yeah, and he was involved in a very turmoilous. You know, a tough times in America history in terms of the Cold War and things like that. So he was there. You know, he was there in through a lot of things. So he's got a good eye. He's just not some reporter that comes along with a libertarian non-interventionist view. He has a lot of background, very intelligent man, very deep thinker. His books are incredible because, I mean, his last book, you know, Will We Be Around in 2014, you know, that book that he just wrote, you know, it's quite a read. So he's a great resource. to really get you to think about what is the U.S., what are is the foreign – I mean, that's, I guess that's where you got to start, Rex. What is the foreign policy of this country? You know, because if you look at the last two wars, Libya, the drone kills, intervention in sovereign nations like in the Ukraine, backing revolutionaries and Nazis and arming rebels to invade a sovereign country like Syria because Qatar wants to build a pipeline through there, you know, is that our foreign policy? It sure seems like it because that's, you know, that's kind of pretty big stuff. And so that's the question you have to ask yourself is, what do you believe? You know, what's right? And do we have that, you know, peace through strength that Reagan had? And is that an acceptable mindset? Because if that's, if you go, I believe that, and that's how I want my country to run, I want my country to quit, you know, wasting hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars all over the world, blowing the crap out of everything, spreading democracy, you know, to end up with nothing, end up losing the war, you know, and or and take that money and spend it in America and fix America, because we're falling apart in this country. Yeah, it's a lie. It's part of that.
It's, I mean, yeah, you're right. We're falling apart. Why aren't we fixing things here? I mean, what do we have here? We got a war on drugs. We got a war on poverty. We got a war on liberty. We got a war on civility. We got a war on Christians. We got a, you know, yeah, war on having a border. I mean, we got a zillion wars going on here. They declare one every other day. Why don't we fix our own house? I mean, you know, it's good to help other people out. And if there is a true existential threat, which I believe that the Soviet Union was, Nazi Germany was, but Russia is not. Russia is not the Soviet Union, and the Germans are not Nazis today. In fact, we're the ones that supported the Nazis in Ukraine. That's besides the point, but it's dishonest because we pretend we're the good guys, but our foreign policy is not a good foreign policy. And when I say it's not good, it's not good from the perspective of just war for a civilized republic, and it's not good from the view of a plundering imperialist nation. I mean, if you're going to go empire, go full-on empire, not this pansy stuff where we get all the negative effects of empire with none of the benefits. If you're going to go empire, go full empire. Be honest about it. You know, go full barbarian.
Conan, what is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of your women.
That is a barbaric imperial policy. You know, so do that. But no, we don't even do that. So I mean, you know, we got all the baggage that comes with being an imperial plunderer, and none of the benefits. And yet we're still pretending to be a rational, civilized actor on the world stage. It's chaotic. It's because we have a parasite that has taken over our government, and you got to get it back. By the way, folks, in about 60 seconds, you're going to lose the live feed. So if you want to listen live, 646-649-1013. If you're in the Internet or a podcast, just keep rolling. It'll keep playing. Chris, to you, and I guess we'll try to wrap it up in the next 10 minutes.
Well, I just think, you know, I mean, that's the conversation, and that's what's heavy on my heart right now. And that's what Ukraine – I mean, Syria exposed it. You know, forget it. Go back. Iraq was the beginning. Afghanistan, I mean, we're totally failed there. You know, there's so many things that you don't see anything in the news. Now, when Bush was in power, Afghanistan was in the news every day. But, you know, everything from death of our soldiers to bad policies to, you know, I mean, it's just terrible. And, the thing, you know, our soldiers getting killed by our allies to the Taliban resurging, they're just waiting for us to go. And the worst one is when they traced money going to these defense contractors that ended up getting to the Taliban. Now, on purpose or just, you know, total corruption, I don't know, all the way to an increase in the opium trade by 40%. When the Taliban were in control, they shut that crap down because they're very fundamentalist in their beliefs. And we're there, and the opium trade is soaring around the world. I mean, it's just, it's insanity, Rex. And it ain't like we didn't have a little history to look at Afghanistan as far as defeating and occupying, because we had Russia. That was the final one that finally collapsed them economically. And so, you know, you've got that debacle. And I don't want this to come across as if I'm anti-military, because I'm not. Every generation of my family, back to the beginning, you know, pre
colonial era, has been in the military in some war, in some sense or another. It's not the military. It shames me to think that what we use our military for, and the destruction to our young people and the disabilities and the suicides and burning deleting their record, so they got to start all over. When my son got back from his first tour, he had some disabilities, but didn't knock him out. But he was starting to get messed up, and by the time his second tour was over, and I told him, having experienced, because I'm Vietnam era, having experienced, all my buddies never getting taken care of, I told my son while he was still in Germany after they got out of Iraq's second tour, I said, you get in there and you get everything logged, every ache, every pain, everything. You get it all on record before you come back to the States and before you, if you choose to get out of the Army. And you make sure, because once you're out trying to get care, go back in and say, I messed up and I didn't know it then, but I know now, whatever the case may be. Don't be a tough guy. Get in there taken care of. And because of that, he was able to get, his stuff logged and taken care of in terms of disabilities. But most guys, they go and they, rah, 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 I'm an American, red, white, and blue. Yeah, I'm going to go fight for my country and freedom. And, of course, they're spying on us, if that's what you think freedom is. But, and then they come back and, I'm a man, I'm tough. My leg don't work real good, but, I'm a man. And then 10 years later, they can't walk and they need a knee replacement and they can't get it. And I heard the horror stories from my non-buddies. So, I don't want to sound like I'm anti-military. I'm anti, what do they call it? What did Eisenhower call it? The industrial war complex.
Military industrial complex. Yep.
And Eisenhower warned us, and I would think he knows, considering he was the general of the Second World War. He was a top dog, and then he was president, and he was going out of office. And I love that clip because he's saying, we need to watch this because this is a new industry in America. Because we weren't a war country. We weren't England. We didn't have an empire. We predominantly stayed out of wars. We had to build our military up to go to the First World War and the Second World War. And he said,
but we
this
did it
needs
quick.
To be watched. Yeah, because we're
and
America.
We did it quick, though. Well, listen, I mean, because we had the free enterprise system. If you have a bustling free enterprise, creative, innovative economy, you can turn it into a war machine at the drop of a hat. It doesn't have to be perpetual, but again, as you said, we're not anti-military. Of course not. I think we should have the biggest, baddest, most well-funded, most well-trained, most dangerous and lethal military around. I do believe it should consist of our Navy, which includes the airplanes, and Marines. And if you're ever going to call up an army, it should be called up from the militia of the several states in which every able-bodied man and woman serve from age 16 to age 60. But we're not there yet. We should go to that. That's very important. We've done shows about the constitutional militia of the several states pursuant to the unamended, unaltered rules expressed in the Constitution. But besides the point, peace through strength is exactly that. You have a military that is capable, that is well-funded, that is superior, okay, and one that has high morale and can kick ass at the drop of a hat when it needs to. But you use it for strictly defensive purposes or where there is a true and vital interest that needs intervention and not willy-nilly chaotic regime-toppling chaos that does nothing other than fund debt, destruction, and death, which is what we have now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a dark subject, isn't it?
They've given it to us. The rise of the neocons has put it in our laps. And the fact is that this is one of those issues, Chris, and I think we should go into final thoughts now, but this is one of those issues that if you express true conservative, constitutional, peace through strength position, you can get people from across various political stripes to agree.
And when you show them someone like Rand Paul, and guess what? Despite everybody trying to label him as a neocon and some of his erroneous, you know, flowery language regarding Ukraine and Russia, I mean, I heard him call Putin a KGB thug. But Putin was a KGB thug. Now he is the president of the Russian Federation. There is no KGB, and frankly, if he's a thug, he's a thug. You contain him when necessary, but Crimea is in his backyard. We shouldn't be messing with it. Besides the point, the Heritage Foundation speech he gave on foreign policy, where he talked a lot about Reagan last year, which we played some clips on, is very well thought out. The principles are correct. And, of course, in the heat of the moment, you can have some differences. And, by the way, you know, let's quit nitpicking every little policy. Policies happen in real time. Principles are what count. You elect people to go in with principles because what's going to happen when they get there, you have no idea, and neither do they. So things are going to change because the circumstances change, but the principles don't change. How they're applied does. And when you hear someone like Rand Paul and someone like Ted Cruz with their well-thought-out foreign policy positions, and then you hear chaotic insanity coming out of the mouths of people like Jihad Jane McComet and mealy-mouthed wussiness projecting weakness from people like Barack, community organizer Obama, that's exactly what we do not want. And the only way you're going to get the rational adults to go in there and prosecute this properly is if you create a grassroots tsunami to get these people elected, to defend the positions of the ones that are under attack, like Justin Amash, and to further the ones that can have a chance at dislodging the rhinos, like Matt Bevin and Joe Miller and whoever, I can't remember the names, challenging Lindsey Graham and all that kind of stuff. That's what you have to do. And you can give them money. Don't give it to the party. You give it to the candidate directly. You can make phone calls. Most importantly, get other people aware, because if we can get a 2 or 3% turnout increase for the real conservatives this November, it would make 2010 look like a little girl's tea party. Want to go to final thoughts? I think we're out of time to play clips. We're done.
Yeah, no problem. I was just thinking, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the Reagan Revolution. You know, and a lot of people think, you know, we look back at Reagan and his influence on the country, but we don't look at his rise to power, because his rise to power was just as much battle, war, nitpicking, his policies. In that opening clip, you had a little bit of Ford in there being slick with his words about, oh, yeah, well, if he got to power, he would have a different, you know, opinion, you know, his foreign policy, blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm saying? Just that stuff to show weakness or ineptitude or lack of, you know, adult understanding of how dangerous the world is. You know, I think anybody alive today, especially, you know, the world of the internet, knows how freaking dangerous the world is. You don't hear from Fox until they want to amp you up, you know, for another war. But if you get on the internet, you can look all over the world and go, holy crap, man, there's a lot of crap going on out there. It's really dangerous. And so I don't think we have the naive culture that we had in the past, you know, that only got their news through three alphabet soup networks. But Reagan was attacked. He was criticized. He was insulted. He was talked down to. It was a constant barrage against him. He won all but one state because he had a message and he had a mass roots tsunami. Literally, it was just incredible. People were sick of the status quo. You know, from Nixon and his debacles, and the Republican Party going down to 18%, and Carter, and, you know, running Ford. You know, it was just a mess, and people were sick of it. And Reagan, you know, he just slipped right in there and just had a solid message. He had an American message. He had a peaceful message, and he was inundated with personal freedom, economic responsibility, you know, which is what you hear from, you know, Cruz and Rand and Lee and the rest of them, is the damn Constitution, the rule of law, personal freedom, you know, what this country stands for, the core principles of the country. That was his message, was not that complex. And he came in a terrible time in history and wiped it out, you know, won just a landslide win, and then turned around and won again and went away. And he changed our country very quickly. And like you said earlier, you know, I don't agree with everything he did, but he also had a contentious Congress that he had to fight and battle with and deal with. And so it's that's where that compromise issue gets in there. You know, you're still trying to get stuff done. You're still trying to govern. And sometimes you don't get the best deal, you know, on the table. But for the most part, turned our country, you know, within a year or two. In fact, really, if you think about it, the important thing was attitude. You know, the moral attitude of the country under Ronald Reagan was we can't, you know, that thing that Obama won on, that hope and change, which was just felonious socialist crap. But, you know, Reagan won on America's great. We are a great people. You know, we're a moral people. You know, we're the light of the world. We're the city, shining city on the hill, and we deserve to be great. That was the message, and it was powerful. And like I said, if you go back and you do the study and the research, you'll find out they kicked the crap out of him on a daily basis. They did not want him in power. They didn't want him to be heard. Every time he spoke anywhere, immediately the neocons and the rhinos and the Democrats would get on the news behind him. You know how Fox will have an interview and then they'll bring up their panel and tear that person apart after they've left and can't rebuttal it. They did the same thing to Reagan. We have the exact same battle going on today as we did then. The power structure of the night circle of hell where you live and doesn't want to lose power to these constitutionalists, because the Constitution says all these organizations and departments, and, you know, whether it's the war machine or the Department of, you know, Ecology or whatever, all these entities, these non-constitutional government entities aren't supposed to have the power they have. So they're always going to be threatened by a Rand or a Cruz or a Lee or a Reagan. And that's the important thing. So don't think it's tough now. You know, oh, my God, they're beating up on Rand. Well, you ain't seen nothing yet. If the guy runs, it's going to get ugly. Look at the last primary. It was ugly. You'd think that the Democrat Party was running against the conservatives, you know, by the crap that came out of the Romney camp and the RNC, because they had their guy picked. They had their status moderate, and he ain't a moderate. He's a progressive liberal, but their moderate status, and it was his turn, just like it's going to be Jeb Bush's turn. And that's important to understand that. So that means they have to destroy these guys who are fighting for you. That's really what it's about. And it is no different. We've faced it many times in this country. In fact, you go all the way back to the beginning and the founding of the country, you will see the exact same battle between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. It's you know, Hamilton and those guys. It was the exact same battle. These massive central government, all the power in the elites, the central bankers, you know, the whole thing. That group wanted to shape America one way, and then the Anti-Federalists wanted state power, individual sovereignty, limited centralized government, you know, free markets, trade, peace, you know, all that stuff. And it's the exact same battle. You know, it's all right there. We got 250 years of history, and you think it's tough, then you haven't studied history, because it's been bad before. It's been bad since the beginning. This is a never-ending battle, and you got to fight it, and you got to win it. And this is the greatest country that ever existed in the history of the world, and things suck right now really bad. IRS, NSA, perpetual wars, preemptive strikes, drone killing villagers at weddings. It's terrible what's going on in our country. And I despise it because it doesn't represent me, but it's my country. So it's a terrible feeling in my heart, but it's not the America I know, and it's not the America we can be. And it's time to change it. 2014 is important. 2014 will set the stage to 2016, so I'm not worried about 2016 until it comes. But 2014 is very important. Back to you. Rex?
I'm sorry, I threw up a little bit when you said Jeb Bush. I had to clear my throat.
Yeah, no, what you said is very true. I think some of us forget, well, maybe we don't. We weren't even alive. You're not even old enough to know what happened back then. As I've quoted a couple of times on the show recently, and it's in our on our Facebook page, Liberty's Thunder. It's also posted in Chris's group, Liberty's Talk. I cracked open The Age of Reagan, The Conservative Counterrevolution, 1980 to 1989 by Stephen F. Hayward. And I'm going to read from the first two pages of Chapter 3, which starts off with a quote from Margaret Thatcher. "We were not to know it at the time, but 1981 was the last year of the West's retreat before the axis of convenience between the Soviet Union and the Third World. There is new leadership in America, which gives confidence and hope to all in the free world." And then he goes on to talk about just after Reagan was inaugurated, and he goes, "Leading media hatchet man Sam Donaldson asked Reagan what he thought the Soviet Union's long-range intentions were. 'Do you think, for instance,' Donaldson asked, gilding his question, 'the Kremlin is bent on world domination that might lead to continuation of the Cold War? Or do you think that under the circumstances, détente is possible?' In the course of pursuing the presidency, Reagan had moderated several of his saucier positions on domestic issues such as Social Security and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Donaldson's question was designed to see whether Reagan would now trim his hardline rhetoric about the Soviet Union, and Donaldson's use of the phrase world domination was a specific reference to what liberals long thought a laughable and unserious tick of conservative anti-communist rhetoric. More broadly, what was on the minds of the foreign policy elite was whether Reagan, like Richard Nixon before him, would embrace at least a modified détente once in office. Reagan's answer stunned the room. This is Reagan. "Well, so far, détente has been a one-way street that the Soviet Union has used to pursue its own aims. I know of no leader of the Soviet Union since the revolution, and including the present leadership, that has not more than once repeated in the various communist congresses they hold their determination that their goal must be the promotion of world revolution and a one-world socialist or communist state. Now, as long as they do that, and as long as they, at the same time, have openly and publicly declared that the only morality they recognize is what will further their cause, meaning they reserve unto themselves the right to commit any crime, to lie, to cheat, in order to attain that, that that is moral, not immoral, and we operate on a different set of standards. I think when you do business with them, even at a détente, you keep that in mind." That was it. Next question. There was an audible gasp among the press corps in the briefing room. Some of Reagan's own aides, cowering in the corners of the room, blanched. This was not the way world leaders talked about other nations. This was the most blunt presidential language since Harry Truman dressed down Soviet Foreign Minister Vladimir Molotov. Now, the crazy thing is that Putin can get up and give that speech today about our neocon foreign policy. But at the time, the Washington establishment hated Reagan. When he said stuff like that, they just freaked out.
This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
So it's we've been here before, and someone like Rand, someone like Ted, is going to get a lot of flack for the fiery positions they've taken. But they're just talking about constitutional principles, right principles, and applying them to the practical situation today. One of the criticisms both of them are going to get, which interestingly enough the press laid off with a certain senator from Chicago, is that, well, they can talk all this, but governing is a different story altogether. Well, that is true to an extent, but they said the same things about Reagan, and they called him a buffoon. They said he wouldn't be able to do it. You heard Ford in the opening clip there kind of belittling him, but then he got there, and he proved them all wrong. But he also upset some conservatives because he worked with the establishment. He put them in his cabinet. He made George H.W. Bush his vice president, which was something he had to do in order to get the party behind him. But Reagan knew how to put the right people in the right places and the convenient people in the convenient places, and then he knew how to manage them. And yes, there were setbacks. It doesn't always work. Look, governing is messy. Liberty is messy. Things are not always going to go right. It's not going to be hunky-dory, roses, and sunshine.
but you need to get the right people with the right principles in place to affect the right policies that are necessary at that time within the bounds of the Constitution and our conservative tradition. That's not going to happen on a whim. That's not going to happen merely because you listened to this show and posted some articles on Facebook. It's only going to happen if you grow the base of America's liberty lovers, constitutionalists, conservatives, conservative libertarians, and independents who aren't even involved. And the way that you do that is you reach out to them personally. You know, today's gospel reading at Mass was about Jesus talking to the Samaritan woman at the well. Now, men and women at that time didn't talk to each other in public alone, and certainly not a Jewish rabbi talking to a Samaritan woman. But that's the kind of radicalism that Jesus injected. He reached out to everybody. And you have to do the same thing. You have to take that kind of zeal, and you've got to reach out to those people who haven't heard the message of liberty, who haven't heard what real conservatism is. Most people have a preconceived notion. They usually identify with Republicans and these days with neocons. You mentioned the word, they shut down. Explain the positions to them. Explain the Constitution. Explain why someone like Rand Paul, someone like Ted Cruz, irrespective of what happens in 2016, they're up there working right now. They need you to send them help this year. Forget 2016. They need help in the Senate, and they need help in the House. Justin Amash needs help in the House. Trey Gowdy needs help in the House. Louis Gohmert needs help in the House. The only way that's going to happen is to get the message out to other people. So make sure every day you do something to advance the conservative cause for liberty, because the neocon agenda is on its heels, and they're pressing harder. And their current meat puppet in the White House is pushing their agenda more than George W. Bush did. But it's a failing policy, and people can see that. You just have to show them that there are other alternatives and other answers. And whether it's Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton in 2016, nothing will change. It's only going to change if you change it now, and you change it this November, and November starts right now. Get busy, because when times like this happen and the 70s sucked, the 80s could be right around the corner. It won't be the same. It's always going to be different. But we can have mourning in America again. We can be relevant on the world stage as a fair partner and an example instead of derided because we're blowing people up all over the place. We can control our debt principally by outgrowing it and getting a stable monetary system. We can cut taxes and promote free enterprise. Things that you can't even imagine being invented are going to be invented if you unleash the creativity, and that includes our military capability. But it isn't going to happen unless you make it happen. And you can't do it alone, and I can't do it alone, but if every day you reach out to somebody who hasn't heard the message and you convince them to get active, and don't try to convince a committed liberal progressive or a diehard Democrat. 114 million people didn't even vote in the last presidential election. Reach out to those people. Share this show with them. Show them places on the Internet where they can get their own research and cross-reference it. But just get them active, because if we don't stop it now and we don't roll it back to the constitutional bounds and look to a brighter future tomorrow, it'll be exactly what Newt Gingrich said about Mitt Romney winning the election if we nominated him and he won. It'll be managing the decay. Don't manage the decay. Look to the future. Make it morning in America again. We'll be back for Open Lines Thursday, 9 p.m. This is Rex and Trog signing off. And the thunder of liberty rumbles on.
Obligation here to defend Ukraine. And do you think there is a military option, even if we had an obligation?
I'd love to tell you that there is, Andrea, but frankly, I do not see it. I'm glad to see our U.S. military naval presence in the Black Sea. I wish that there were, but I think that these sanctions can really have a serious effect on the kleptocrats, who are the oligarchs and kleptocrats that are part and parcel of the power structure of Vladimir Putin, and those other measures that I told you about. I'd probably have some military exercises with the Baltic countries who are parts of NATO. I'd accelerate, as I mentioned, membership in NATO for Moldova and Georgia, but I do not see a military option.
We had 3 or 4 dozen Republicans in the House, who are cruise Republicans, who basically threatened to bring the House down if John Boehner did not pursue this policy. John knew it was not going to work, but he probably had no choice. I understand his position. But I'm really more concerned about why more Republicans around the country didn't join me in denouncing Ted Cruz. I mean, now we have people who are on the sidelines who are coming forward. But we have to take a stand here. We cannot allow our party to be taken over by the likes of Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. I mean, these are people who are isolationists. I consider them rhinos.
As far as the Tea Party and others are concerned, it's anybody to the left of Ted Cruz is a rhino, a Republican in name only, which, as I say, is an insult. But you know what? The real rhinos are the people in the Tea Party and on the hard right, because they have made it clear over and over again that their allegiance is not to the Republican Party, but to their particular...
Sir, Pentagon's on the secure line. The chairman. Why?
Brewster.
We're hoping to hell here you've got some kind of solution for us.
I know what you're looking for, sir, but Skynet is not ready for a system-wide connection.
That's not what your civilian counterparts over there just told me. They say we can stop this damn virus. Now, I understand there's a certain amount of performance anxiety over there, but your boys are saying that if we plug Skynet into all of our systems, it'll squash this thing like a bug and give me back control of my military.
Mr. Chairman, I need to make myself very clear. If we uplink now, Skynet will be in control of your military.
But you'll be in control of Skynet, right?
That is correct, sir.
Then do it. And Brewster, this thing works. You get all the funding you ever need.
Yes, sir.
And the result has been this horrifying foreign policy and the righteousness behind it. It's interesting that even Russell Kirk back in 91 gave this great speech at the Heritage Foundation where he condemned this kind of spirit, this haughty spirit of our government is always right, and yet he would be called a pinko commie by the neocons today.
Exactly. He was talking about the hubris that had taken over America in the wake of its Cold War victory. Now, I don't believe Reagan would have behaved this way toward Putin, and Nixon certainly would not have done so. But let's take a look at they say that Putin is defying us in Syria. What is he doing in Syria? I'm not a fan of President Assad, but he's been a long time ally of the Russians. They have a naval base of some kind at Latakia. They've sold him weapons, and Assad is under assault from rebels, which include the Al-Qaeda terrorists, who are the dominant force there. And the Russians are standing by their ally, as we did not stand by ours, Mubarak, and when we helped dump him over. And why should they adapt their policy toward American policy when their own interests, as they see them, mean consistency with what they have been going for the last 20 years? Again, we don't seem to be able to understand things from their point of view, and Putin's got a good question when he asks, why are you Americans supporting rebels whose leading fighting force are the very people who brought down the Twin Towers?
These are good questions. These are good questions for John McCain. These are
the McCainiacs, as I've called them. Did you see where McCain said, I'm going to have to dig it up, but McCain said, look, they're not. If they let Snowden in, let's bring Georgia into NATO. In other words, threaten them.
Yeah.
A possible world war.
Yeah, I know it. I know. Did you happen to see, Pat, that column in the Washington Times a few days ago in which Gingrich said that the neocons really have to do some soul-searching over the complete how their interventionist policies have completely backfired overseas? Did you see that?
I did. It said he's Newt's converting on this front as well, I think. But exactly, isn't this not a valid question? We just, Tom, we just got what the other day? We said, 22 embassies got to be shut down. Al-Qaeda is all over the place. They're threatening our people. And so we go into our fortresses over there. First, Obama has said that, you know, Al-Qaeda was on the run. Secondly, we just lost, in the last decade, 6,000 soldiers, 40,000 wounded, lost $2 trillion, you know, killed hundreds of thousands of people, created a million widows and orphans in Afghanistan and Iraq in the, quote, war on terror, and now the enemy's in more places than it was when the war begun? I mean, does that not ask the question, what were these wars all about?
You know, look, and I think this conversation needs to be had before the next presidential election. The neoconservative view of the use of U.S. force has, you know, clearly hurt the Republican Party. Over the last 4 years, we've seen the American people, 6 years, I would say, the American people turn against what happened in Iraq and, in part, the long war in Afghanistan. And we didn't have enough Republicans questioning George W. Bush in 2007 and 2008. And now you're basically advancing that conversation now about what conservatism is.
Well, I think there are important constitutional debates, and I think that's the main objection I have to some of these Republicans who are dismissive and call it frivolous, is that, you know, you can have a different opinion. I'm not saying I'm always right, but a discussion over the Bill of Rights and the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment, when it applies and to whom it applies and whether politicians get to decide when the Constitution applies, I think it's a very important debate. And so I'm glad we had the debate. I'm kind of glad I can sit down now. But
Senator, they decided not to go to the Senate floor. There was 13 hours where either McCain or Graham could have debated you on the floor. Why do you think they didn't?
Well, we've had this debate one time. Last year, Senator McCain and I had an exchange on the floor, and we rarely have much debate in the Senate, but this was a good exchange, and I asked him, this was the debate over indefinite detention, and I asked him, well, if this passes, could you detain an American, send them to Guantanamo Bay without a jury trial? And he said yes. He said basically if they're declared to be a safety risk for the U.S., we could do this. But it begs the question, who gets to determine whether you're a safety risk or whether you're an enemy combatant? But most Americans don't understand it that way. We don't think that you could be accused by a politician. And that's why I tried to make this not about President Obama, because I'm worried about any politician deciding my innocence or guilt without getting a trial.
Well, it's just, again, the perpetual war machine. You were in the elevator briefly with John McCain. You sound like you're in a wind tunnel, Senator. I don't know where you are, but you sound like you're in a You sound like you're in Kazakhstan or something. But
it's top secret. I would like to tell you, but I can't tell you because I'm worried about my whether I'll
Senator
be labeled
from Arizona,
as an enemy combatant.
Urge this body to trust the Republicans. Let me be clear. I don't trust the Republicans, and I don't trust the Democrats. And I think a whole lot of Americans, likewise, don't trust the Republicans and the Democrats because it is leadership in both parties that has gotten us in this mess. You know, my wife and I have two little girls at home. They're 5 and 2. When Caroline was born, our national debt was $10 trillion. Today, it's nearly $17 trillion. In her short 5 years of life, the national debt has grown by over 60%. Madam President, what we are doing to our kids and grandkids, I think, is immoral. Now, I commend the Democrats in this body for their candor. The Democrats and President Obama have been very explicit that it is their intention to raise the debt ceiling and to do so with no conditions whatsoever, just to keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing money without any structural reforms to fix the problems. That is an intellectually consistent position. I think it is a dangerous position, but it is at least candid. And that is the reason why every day for 60 days the Democrats have opposed taking the debt ceiling off the table in this discussion. But unfortunately, one of the reasons we got into this mess is because a lot of Republicans were complicit in this spending spree. And that's why so many Americans are disgusted with both sides of this House. Because we need leaders on both sides to do, as my friend from Virginia said, to roll up our sleeves, to compromise, to work together and fix the problem, fix the enormous fiscal and economic problems, stop bankrupting our country. What this issue is all about is very simple. Will we allow the debt ceiling to be raised in an unlimited amount with just a 50-vote threshold? And if the answer to that is yes, we have in effect just voted to raise the debt ceiling because the Democrats hold a majority of this body, 55 seats.
The establishment will grow more and more hysterical the more powerful Rand Paul and Ted Cruz become, and they will gain strength as it's obvious that they're among the few people willing to raise the right question. And I consistently have been on the side of having the courage that Rand Paul and Ted Cruz have. And I think it's sad to watch the establishment grow this way.
We have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. They pack a lot of firepower, but the T-600s are heavy and slow. They are a primitive design.
Who's that?
If you can't outrun them, then you have one option.
Their motor cortex is partially exposed at the back of their neck. A knife to this area will disorient their tracking device, but not for long. Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important you are. This is John Connor.
If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
John Connor. I gotta find this guy.